On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! What a wonderful day this has been. This was one of those factory-ordered, beautiful, gorgeous Monday afternoons. It's a wonderful day because it's a Monday, first of all, and that means my week begins. Get to get back together with you guys, hang out, cuss and discuss, carry on some conversation. Conversation radio at its very finest right here on America's liberal voice, The Horn. But the day was better, even more so than one might otherwise expect. We've got some company here today, and it might not be fair to say company, family. My dearest sister and her husband are up for a visit for the first time in, frankly, eons. And my brother-in-law is. How can I say? He is the king of... I don't know if king is fitting. He's the king of, the duke of, the absolute archetype of boiled shrimp. They live in Mobile, you see. And before setting out, loaded up a cooler with fresh shrimp straight out of the Gulf of Mexico. And, you know, you can buy it frozen, whatever... It ain't the same thing. You can get the stuff in the quick frozen for the crackly crunch, you know, in the your grocery store's freezer, and it says, you know, harvested in Thailand or whatever. No. Shrimp as defined as shrimp, as defined as wonderful, comes from the Gulf of Mexico. Comes from the Gulf Coast. And my brother-in-law whipped up a batch of them today that was just to die for. I mean, much more, and I'm going to need a shrimp 12-step program. I've been garming them all day long. My center of gravity's changed. Oh, if you've never had them fresh straight out of the Gulf, you don't know what shrimp tastes like. And these were just magnificent. Oh, they were good. So a little bit of a program note for you. We're going to be running around and having some fun, so I will likely not be on the air tomorrow night. But I'm here tonight. You know, I don't get to, you know, Mobile, Alabama is a long way from here in the hills and hollers of West Virginia. So I'm hoping we'll spend some time together and have a lot of fun and try to make the best of this visit and enjoy our time together. So where do we go today? What an invigorating conversation we had Friday evening on Friday's program. It was absolutely electric. Conversation going back and forth, and apparently it really caught with some people. I received a good bit of comment on it. I'll just share this one comment we got from our buddy Scott in Sweden. He said, wow, was Friday's show great. What's with America that millions aren't tuning in? Yeah, indeed. But look, someday they will. For now, this can be your, don't make it a secret. Share the information with others. But if you were here for Friday's show, you know that it was just an amazing dialogue, an amazing discussion. The kind of thing that can only happen here. It's not happening anywhere else. So, you know, it's conversation radio. That's why we call it this. That's why it is what it is. Let's go straight away to the phones, however. Had someone roll in here, and I hate to keep people waiting just because I want to run my yap. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello? Okay, well, I guess they bailed out. But anyway, so whatever you did with your weekend, well, I'll tell you what I did with mine. Over the weekend, well, you know, Saturday nights, I'm here behind the desk rolling the weekend programming. And Saturday night at 9 p.m. for me means one thing and one thing only. It means Billy Shears and Night Sounds. So I was here rolling Billy Shears' show, but before that, I was also on the side watching the Civil Forum from Brokeback Church or whatever it's called, that thing that huckster Rick Warren operates. And he had Barack Obama and old 894 had them come and sit down separately. I watched some of each, and I couldn't help thinking that the McCain part of it looked like a setup. It sounded like a setup. It felt like a setup. It felt like something was dodgy and wrong and fake and fraudy. Guess what? I was right. And we'll get into why in a minute. Let's see if this individual is with us this time. Hey, welcome to the program.
Sorry about that.
Well, hi, Susan. What's up?
I accidentally hit my mute button. I do apologize.
No, that's okay. You accidentally banned yourself from your own phone call.
Yeah. I was calling in about Saddlegate myself.
Oh, is that what it is now, Saddlegate? Yeah, that's good. That's
well,
good. That works for me.
You know, great tag, you got to admit. What I really liked was the fact, you know, that did you catch the bit that McCain did with this story about the guard?
Well, let's back up before we get to that, if you don't mind, Susan, just to make sure that everybody's on the same page here in the choir. And that is the fact that when McCain came on, Rick Warren, the charlatan huckster, you know, the purpose-driven charlatan, said, you know, how would you like your time in the cone of silence? And yeah, my friends, I had my ear to the wall.
Yeah, he wasn't even there.
He wasn't even there. He was somewhere where he could be. Yeah, maybe he was sitting in a bar somewhere, or maybe he was on the BS Express, watching Barack Obama's answers and getting everything scripted for him.
What I particularly liked was the McCain camp's response to this when it came out. They said Senator McCain was not anywhere where he could see or hear a live feed. Okay, that didn't account for the fact that his staffers could probably hear it.
See, don't you love the way they play hopscotch with the truth?
Yes.
Senator McCain was nowhere that he could see or hear. No. But the entirety of Senator McCain's staff damn sure was. And they were.
Oh, yeah.
But you know what? He's internet illiterate, so we don't have to worry about it because it's not like anybody could text him or email him the stuff. The guy can't even open an email attachment, so I don't know what to make of it.
No, they just texted Black, and he gave him the answers.
Well, anyway, you slice it, though. So what was the one that grabbed you?
Okay. McCain told this touching story about how, and that's another problem. I have a new thing with McCain. It's kind of play on Joe Biden's comment about Giuliani, you know, noun and a verb and 9/11.
Yeah.
McCain is noun and a verb and POW. Because every other word that came out of his mouth.
My friends, I don't want to talk about the fact that I was tortured every day for 5 years and that qualifies me to be the President of the United States. My friends, I don't want to talk about that. I don't want to talk about the fact that I'm a real live hero and Barack Obama is just, well, you know, you ought to be scared of him.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk about that.
He told this touching story about how on Christmas, he was allowed to stand outside his cell, and this guard came around and silently scratched a cross in the dirt with his sandal. And they were two men standing there.
Go ahead. I've got the background music.
He stole it from Alexander Solzhenitsyn.
Yeah, it's a deadlift, right.
Yep. Gulag Archipelago.
Well, that's okay. When he was in the Hanoi Hilton, and of course his favorite, when he was being tortured and he had to rat out his mates, he gave them the starting defensive or offensive line, or but perhaps the water boy's name from the Pittsburgh Steelers. Never mind the fact that in his little book he says it was the Green Bay Packers. Dude's really, really old, and we can't expect his memory to be that good. I mean, come on.
Well, I have a problem. Okay, now, a lot of people say don't talk about when he was POW. Sorry, folks. I'm going to talk about it. Because the man sang like a canary. Now, I can't blame him. He was trying to get special treatment. No problem. But what he did was he also, in the process of singing like a canary.
Look, yeah, that part of it I don't have a problem with, Susan. If you stomp on my foot, I will tell you what you want to know.
Sure.
I don't have to hang out for the rest of the program.
What I have a problem with is what he did when he sang is he gave up the attack plan that the U.S. was using, which meant that a whole lot of other pilots and crews got shot down and or killed because he opened his gap.
Yeah, the similarities between him and George Bush get a little bit closer every day. Because after all, while George Bush was getting himself admitted to the Champaign unit of the Texas Air National Guard, there were other people from other young men from Midland, Texas, who were going, and they now have going to Vietnam, and they have their name on a wall. And they died, they literally died for George Bush.
The only difference is, if you read the military code regarding prisoners, you can sing like a canary, but what you say had damn well better be false.
Unless you're an admiral's son.
Yeah, well.
Unless you've already got a track record of really not being that sharp.
And to me, he got those boys killed. Why aren't people talking about that?
Well, because it's deemed not polite.
Bullshit. Pardon my language.
I know. But it's deemed... No. See, what you have to do, there are rules here, and Michael Moore addressed this very, very, very well in an opinion piece he put out a few days ago about memo to Democrats, how to lose this election, too.
Uh-huh.
And he dealt specifically with this war hero issue. And what he said, and I tend to agree with him, is that you can't give away this issue. Doggone it.
I can access on my computer right now transcripts of radio interviews he gave to Radio Cuba, all sorts of other radio interviews he gave that were anything but favorable. Now, I have no problem with that. You do what you gotta. But it doesn't make him look good.
Well, listen to this, Susan. This is what Michael Moore had to say. He said, number one, and remember, this is the title of this is How the Democrats Can Blow It in 6 Easy Steps.
Mm-hmm.
One, keep saying nice things about McCain. If you want to help elect McCain, keep blessing him as if he were the white knight who accidentally hopped on the wrong horse. Keep reminding a country at war that he, and he alone, is a war hero. That he's been good on global warming and campaign finance. Say that enough, and you know what happens? People start to believe it. You've sold them on the idea that McCain isn't a bad egg, and they do not hear the rest of what you have to say. But John McCain is 4 more years of George W. Bush. Don't remind people that McCain wants to help the oil companies even more than Bush did. don't bring up that he wants to outlaw abortion. Back away from painting him as the guy who thinks it's a good idea to stay in Iraq until pigs fly. That way, if you keep praising him, you can send a mixed message to the less informed who are simply not going to figure it out. When they walk into a voting booth, they will see two names on the ballot. Barack Obama, war hero. Trust me, this ain't Sweden you're living in. War hero wins every time. And that's the thing. And that's the thing. Every time somebody brings him up, you know, Barack Obama or any, you know, upper level, well, I certainly reverence John McCain's service. He is a bona fide war hero.
He's a bona fide screw up.
He is that. I mean, five aircraft crashes. You know, come on. You know, one's an accident. Two is strange, oddly coincidental. Three, ground him for a while. Five, never. I don't know. I think after crash four, he should probably have been grounded.
Yeah. Here's another point. And this isn't getting very much play, but it oughta. John McCain had approximately 20 hours of air combat time. After he got back.
Well, remember, this is important. Remember, he is not a fighter, was not a fighter pilot. He's a bomber.
I know.
And that's a different breed.
Yeah. After he got back, he got an incredible pile of medals. And the weird thing was, at least two of those medals required, witnesses.
Yeah, external verification.
They didn't bother to follow that kind of, Yeah.
Right, yeah, sure.
They waived it, you know. And it just, blows me away that he can get away with this. He got this incredible pile of medals. It was something like, I think it comes down to every 2.5 hours he got a medal for.
Gee, oh my God.
My father dove into burning oil in the Coral Sea when his aircraft carrier went down. He didn't get diddly for that.
Oh, God. Well, but if you're an admiral's son, it's a little different.
Yeah, and it just...
But the thing is, the Brokeback thing or Saddleback thing or Saddlebred or Saddlehorn,
yeah.
Whatever.
It was a
fraud. You know, I'd love to know, and I didn't tune in early enough, Susan, to find out how they determined who went first and who went second.
Well, they claimed it was a coin toss, just before the show started, but that was a lie, since he wasn't even in the building.
And, you know, but then again, the thing was, you know, I'm not a sucker. I didn't fall off the turnip truck yesterday. This was a religion. This was straight. Look, for Barack Obama, this was straight out of the 23rd Psalm, okay? This was a classic case of thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies.
Exactly. However, here is something that may cheer you up. John Sidney may have stepped in it to the point where, let me put it this way, in Colorado, he has Ken Salazar and Bob Schaefer after him. One Republican, one Democrat. You know why?
Why is that?
He wants to renegotiate the Water Rights Pact.
Folks in those Western states get
bonkers.
Yeah, folks in Western states get real antsy about water rights, don't they?
Yeah, especially when somebody from Arizona is talking about it, because it's the people in Colorado, Utah, and places like that give to people in Arizona and California, and they're not happy. He may have just lost Colorado.
Here's hoping.
Knock on wood.
I just hit myself in the head. Knock on wood.
Anyway, if you want to read the article about the Colorado thing, it's up on Sendab. As a whole bunch of stuff about Saddlegate. I just love Saddlegate. It just cracked me up. And I'm waiting for somebody absolutely pin that Solzhenitsyn quote, because Solzhenitsyn is supposedly McCrazy's favorite author.
Yeah, I'm buying that. Not.
Not. Frankly, he hasn't got the brains to read something that dense.
No, he's too dense to read something that dense. I mean, he just is. Susan, thanks a lot.
No problem. You give my love to the kids and Agnes.
Sure will. Talk to you soon.
And by the way, you're killing me with the stories about the shrimp.
Oh God, Susan. I'm a seafood guy, you know, la fruit de mer, all that stuff. Nothing tastes like a shrimp boil that my brother-in-law has done. Holy mackerel.
Alaskan king crab.
Oh, gosh, yes, but I'd rather have the Gulf shrimp any day.
No. I don't mean the kind you can get where you're at. I mean the kind that comes.
I know. No. I know. No, but I'd still rather have the shrimp. It's like being able to eat butter, and you can still taste the ocean, and wow, and the recipe he uses for his boil is just it's like proprietary magic or something. Oh God, it was good.
Am I gonna have to twist your arm to get the recipe?
I don't have the recipe. No, this is his genius, and it is just oh.
Telling you have a weepy news ninja.
Yeah, it's just little cocktail sauce, some saltines, and the potatoes and the corn done. It's just an absolute Cajun feast.
The food porn.
No, yeah, well, you know, we've got to have our food porn segment in every program. And shrimp are very low fat, so yeah. There you go.
Yeah, I know, but they're also extremely high in protein.
Yeah, that's that's a tough one for you. Yeah.
Yeah. But, well, what I do is I just arrange to take medication ahead of time.
See, we all sat down and had these huge plates full of boiled shrimp, and then after that, you move into what's called the browsing or grazing stage, where when you walk through the kitchen, you just stop and you peel a couple and just pop them and good.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Nectar of the gods.
Absolutely. And see, I can we were talking earlier out in the house, and I said, you know, I can understand that first guy or woman who looked down there and said, you know what, I'm going to eat one of them little critters. It might be good. As opposed to the one who reached down there and pulled up an oyster and said, and shucked that thing open and said, I'm getting after this.
I've never been able to understand people who eat raw oysters.
Oh, but I do. I mean, I love them. I'm just thinking about the one who was so hungry the first time through that he was willing to eat it.
Well, if you're that hungry, you're willing to eat raw eggs too, and I'm just not into that. I was raised in Seattle. I eat gooey duck. I eat all sorts of fish. But
now, see, I have never had gooey duck, and I would love to try it.
Oh. It is a super, super rich giant clam.
Oh, I know what it is, and semi-obscene looking, yes.
Yes, that too.
Yeah, but I've seen it on Food Network and all of that stuff, and it's so exotic. And look at this. And apparently it's real big in sushi joints in Japan and things like that. I've never tried it, but I'd love to.
You've got to be real careful about cooking it, because if you cook it wrong, it's like trying to eat shoe leather. But if you do it right.
No, I heard if you overcook it, it's like eating a rubber band.
There's something like that.
Keep chewing. Ain't nothing else going to happen.
Right. If you do it right, it's just heavenly, and it's just incredibly rich. You can't eat much of it because it's so rich.
It's on my list. But I am a happy, happy man today.
Well, come out to to the West Coast here, we'll drive up to Hood Canal, and we'll dig for Dewey Duck.
Oh, man. And see, that's the same thing. To have them fresh, that's the kick. Because you can't get around fresh.
What's better is I have relatives who have waterfront property on Hood Canal.
Oh, hot diggity. Yeah. Well, Susan, like I said, have a wonderful evening, and we will talk soon.
You too. Give my love to Agnes.
All right, will do. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
News Ninja Susan. And the business, what won't they rip off? Alexander Solzhenitsyn's been in the dirt for 2 weeks, tops, and already old 894 is out there plagiarizing him. Didn't we talk a little bit about right-wing plagiarism on Friday evening's program? Wasn't that part of ELO's little letter to the editor? Yeah, I kind of think it was. So, that's where we begin this evening, and Lord knows there's a million other places. I'm hoping we will hear from some of our friends down at Coal River Mountain Watch later this evening. We'll be talking a little bit about the national rollout of their new campaign for the Coal River Wind Project. I think you will find it, if you haven't already been to coalriverwind.org to sign the petition to help advance the Coal River Mountain Wind Project, it would be really nice if you did so. It doesn't cost you anything, and you can, having done that, really be a part of a part of the solution that may save one of the last great mountains in southern West Virginia from the mountaintop removal demolition crowds, high explosives. So do that, and I'm hoping we'll be talking to some of the folks from Coal River Mountain Watch about this specific issue later on in the program. So sort of, you know, keep your ears open. And with any luck at all, that will come along here in the next hour or so. And we might even run just so that you can hear it for yourself, the ad that is running in regard to advancing this campaign. I think it's a dandy. Of course, John Fox and I had a hand in the production of it, so we're terribly, terribly, terribly biased. But I don't think that changes anything. It's still wonderful. In fact, you know, why the heck not? Let's do give this a listen here in a minute, and then we'll move on to some other things. And there's a lot of stuff that just sort of boiled over from last week into this week that bears a good listen. But let's take a moment and check out the news, because it started today, a big advertising blitz in southern West Virginia, and an attempt to get this out on a national basis. So by all means, give a listen and check this out. Here we go.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org. 854-2182.
Isn't that nice? And every bit of it, it's not like one of those Walker cat ads where you have to sort out the stupid lies from the stupider lies. This is all 100% fact-based truth. it can. The wind farm can save that mountain, and wind energy can save countless more mountains in the region, not just in West Virginia, but in Kentucky, in Virginia. Absolutely. And it's a turning of the corner toward the future. Now, on the other hand, just so you can sort of see how the other side operates, I was reading along the other day. I think I was over at Politico.com. And, you know, Politico, please. And I see this mention of Harry Reid delivering a major speech about energy at the Democratic National Convention. Yeah, Harry Reid, Senate Majority Leader. Now, never mind the fact that my goofy, twisted, laughter-loving mind first thought of Darren McGavin crowing, "It's a major award!" as he pulled the fishnet stocking leg lamp from the box in A Christmas Story. Do not think of Harry Reid's major energy speech in those terms. Stop it. Stop thinking about it. Damn it, stop giggling. Stop visualizing Magic Drawers Harry running a prurient hand up and down those fishnets and declaring, "It must be Italian, it says fragile." Stop thinking about him casting a longing glance at that stiletto-heeled pump or running his hand across the oh-so-sexy harlot fringe of the lampshade. Stop it, damn it. Never mind the fact that Harry damn sure couldn't deliver an address on abuse of constitutional freedoms, seeing as how he helped hone the knife that got sunk hilt deep in the Fourth Amendment. Besides, a major address like that might be a major embarrassment, seeing as how Harry's taken a buzzard gagging load of money from Big Verizon and Obama played footsie with him in the telecoms in the, you know, final FISA vote. And we can't exactly have Harry giving a speech on the rule of law, since he still hasn't learned the meaning of contempt of Congress. No, that wouldn't work. A speech on how to crack the whip in the majority is going to read like the libretto to a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta with Harry singing the poor little buttercup role. Harry Reid on stopping right-wing judicial activism doesn't exactly scan either, does it, Justice Alito? No. Quit laughing! This is a serious commentary. So a major speech on energy it is. Leon McDuff. Well, anyway, some ways down the page in the comments following the article about the major energy speech that Harry Reid's going to give, I read the following comment from, you know, like a blog, you know, the following, and it said, "What we keep hearing from the left is the same sources of energy from the 70s, 80s, wind and solar. God forbid if we go several days without sunshine and wind. We still need our own source of oil." Now, at this point, it's only fair to point out that I'm probably a little bit more twisted than the average bear. I'm certainly, you know, after 8 years of the Bush administration, I'm way more paranoid. It's earned paranoia, mind you. But it's paranoia any way you slice it. It's either that or rational, fact-driven concern. You pick. I'm scared to death of these right-wing bastards. I really am. While I'm not particularly worked up about a 6-foot-7-inch Arab trailing a portable dialysis machine from cave to cave in the burbs of the Pakistani tribal zone, wing nuts with a Jones on for liberals kind of terrify me just because we never know where they'll strike next. We've seen two right-wing assassins take aim at our own in the last 3 or so weeks, and the victims weren't even people who were high profile. They were just workaday liberals who were guilty of, not of any particular act. What they were guilty of was the way they were characterized by patriots, like the Savage Wiener and Falafel Boy Bill O'Reilly. There you are, you're a liberal. One day you're comparing zucchinis in the produce section, and bang, some wingnut decides you're a threat to marriage, and the next thing you don't know, you're a victim in an assassination that the for-profit media won't even call terrorism. I mean, we've been listening to right-wing murder mavens trying to bust out their Iran buzz for bloody, and I do mean bloody, months. So it's safe to say I'm a little unsettled. You know, touchy, even. Now, what unsettled me in this particular instance is this idea that this commenter brought up about wind and solar not being effective when there's no wind or solar. or sunshine. How could that be? Is there anything out there that could affect the ability of the earth to receive blessed sunlight? Kind of wonder. Wait a minute.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're gonna like it. I think you're gonna feel you belong. Nocturnal vacation. Unnecessary sedation. You wanna feel at home. Cause you belong.
Okay, it's beginning to come to me. Yeah, there it is. Wait a minute. A few little nuclear devices, let's say, going off here and there around the globe. We learned this a couple of decades back, but we haven't really thought about it a lot. But those few little nuclear devices going off, that might trigger something that... nuclear winter. No sun. No solar power. Nuclear winter. Now, never mind that the comment that I read on Politico is just uber geeky.
Solar? Oh, that's so 80s. Next thing, you'll want a Cyndi Lauper in every pot.
It's almost like this Zwieback gnawing little moron thinks the sun got weaker between then and now. Maybe it had something to do with the demise of, I don't know, the Pet Shop Boys or something. But with wing nuts, there's no telling. God only knows what'll piss off Bill O'Reilly next. The war on Groundhog Day. Secular Amway salesman. The threat to our God-given right to Tupperware.
You just can't know. Because he's nuts.
So I'm left wondering, what happens if the collective zeitgeist of an America that's ready to be serious about wind and solar actually threatens the wingnuts enough to make them contemplate ways to keep solar from being effective? Would the oil and the coal companies who exert more collective power on our government than on any other industries, who are doing everything they can to put the screws to Russia over a set of pipelines, who are already scratching a real powerful itch to drill everywhere on America's coast that doesn't already have a derrick on it, let alone the last pristine American wilderness in existence, whether they find any oil or not? After all, you got to remember, for the bean counters, failed holes, dry holes, are as good as hot ones, because it's all cost of doing business on the final tally. These industries who export more coal to China than gets burned in the U.S., whose capitalist wet dream for Iraq isn't working out quite as planned, is it possible they actually whisper sweet nuclear nothings into Dick Cheney's bionic ear? Would they do that if it looked like we the people, the problem children, were ready to give them the Dear John in favor of, you know, panels and rotors? Would they mutter something about Russia now threatening Poland? Because I saw that. Would they mop their brows with perspiratory concern for the young democracy in Warsaw or Tbilisi? Would they? So at the end of the day, there's only one way to answer that really, really sick question. And that's this. How would the quarterly profit and loss statements look if they sang that song to a Cheney, lashed to the light sweet crude bituminous mast, like some sort of twisted hydrocarbon Odysseus? You want to know what makes me sit up at 3 o'clock in the morning with a little beads of sweat running down? You want to know what just messes with my sleep, really battles me? I'm willing to bet that there are bean counters out there who can make a compelling case for the profit possibilities inherent in nuclear winter. Think of George C. Scott's General Buck Turgidson in Dr. Strangelove saying, Mr. President, I'm not saying we wouldn't get our hair mussed. Forget about it, Jake. It's hydrocarbons. We don't need no stinking sunlight. Yeah. So we'll be back in a minute, hopefully with a conversation about the real hope for America. This is The Horns.
My nightmare. I think you're gonna lie. station. You wanna feel at home, 'cause you belong.
Welcome to my breakdown. I hope I didn't scare you. That's just the way we are when we come down. We sweat and laugh and scream here, 'cause life is just a dream here. You know inside you feel right at.
You know, I think about ways to describe, ways to characterize these right-wing hydrocarbon pushers, and they're nightmare merchants. They really are. Wherever they go, wherever they set their gaze, wherever they put their hooks, nightmares come to life. Nightmares leave the denizens of the dark and start walking about in the daylight. It really. And that's why solutions like the Coal River Wind Farm are so very, very important. And with us on the line right now is our good friend Lorella from Coal River Mountain Watch. Hey, Lorella.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
Oh, if I was any better, I couldn't be any better. How about you?
Great. I'm good.
And pretty really doggone good. Pretty doggone excited, I would think.
Yes, we actually are. We launch our national online campaign tomorrow, and we're predicting, as of right now, we're going to reach over 1 million people tomorrow.
Wow.
And we're doing TV interviews, radio ads. We have an online petition. We're meeting with all the local and state politicians. I met today with one of the guys that's running for governor, and then I met with two of our current House of Delegates representatives. And we are really, really excited. This is something that really could happen, and we're doing everything we can to try to make it happen.
Well, you know, it's been talked about a lot, and there's been a, Lorella, there's been a ton of real live, honest to goodness, skull sweat and planning that went into the very idea of the wind farm, and it's such a simply amazing opportunity to take our sustainable future seriously.
This is the alternative that we have been told over and over and over that we never offer. The fact of the matter is we have to start preparing for a post-coal future. Coal is going to run out. We need to stop burning fossil fuel. And this is a clean, renewable, sustainable future that will give us energy and green jobs forever.
And I don't know if folks necessarily know what you mean when you say that this is something that we take grief about. But anytime we start talking about what mountaintop removal does to communities, somebody will stand up and say, "Oh, how are we ever going to get along without coal?"
Yeah, well, that's basically what I heard today from the Republican guy that's running for governor in the state of West Virginia. Coal is king here. It's very, very difficult.
You mean Joe Manchin?
No,
I'm sorry. I was just being a smart aleck. You don't know.
I lost my train of thought now. He can't see anything except coal. And he believes that, you know, we want to, and he's not alone in this. He believes that we want to destroy jobs and have everybody on welfare, which is simply not true, because the fact of the matter is this particular wind farm in the construction phase, which is 2 years in the construction phase, will create 200 plus locally trained union jobs. Once the construction phase is over, it will create 40 to 50 permanent jobs. And then every 20 years, every 20 to 25 years, those turbines have to be redone. So that is another influx of 200 plus jobs. In comparison, the new proposed coal to liquids plant, which is proposed for the northern part of the state, is offering about 60 jobs.
I'm no math whiz, and everybody knows it, Lorella, but even I can comprehend that green means more good-paying jobs.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we don't want to see anybody lose their job. We certainly don't want this state or even our next-door neighbor.
Let's be clear about something, Lorella. Nobody at Coal River Mountain Watch that I know of, and I think I'm safe saying nobody, has ever said they want anybody to go on welfare or lose their jobs or cast into the outer darkness of the economic miracle none of that. Nobody's
absolutely
ever said that.
Absolutely.
That is all straw man made up bogus hooey.
That's the myth that they perpetrate, which justifies everybody being so upset about the possibility of there not being 5,000 mountaintop removal jobs in the state of West Virginia. That's the myth that they perpetrate.
That's it? 5,000?
5,000. Statewide, there are between 16,000 and 17,000 coal mining jobs statewide. A little over 5,000 of those are on MTR sites. Now, we would maintain, MTR being mountaintop removal, we maintain that along with the green jobs that would be created and the permanent jobs that would be created with the erection of this windmill farm, that if it is deemed that they can no longer do mountaintop removal, and they can still do the traditional underground room and pillar mining, that there will actually be an increase in underground coal mining jobs in the state of West Virginia. At one time, there was 125,000 coal mining jobs in the state of West Virginia, and with mountaintop removal and the mechanization that goes along with it, we have lost over 100,000 jobs in this state with the mechanization and by blowing the tops off the mountains. It takes a whole lot fewer men to run the big cat equipment and to use the explosives than it does to actually access the coal in a traditional manner.
And in so doing, it also destroys local economies.
It destroys the local economy, yes, it does.
And, of course, we talked 100 times, if not 1,000, about what actually the proximity to the an MTR site does to the health of a community, whether
which,
it's
yes, and which is if we can't save this mountain, that will be my backyard.
You're kidding.
No, that will absolutely be my backyard. There are 6,600 acres that's slated for mountaintop removal, and part of that will be right on the hill above me. And as I see the people in this movement that, I refer to as heroes, when I look at their life as it is right now, I see that that is, you know, if this is allowed to continue, if we don't stop this, that's what's down the road for me.
So if a guy like Russ Weeks, who has been connected at one way to one degree or another to mountaintop removal in the past, if this guy, who is the Republican nominee for governor in this state and admittedly has about as much chance of being elected as I do of being made pope, but if he feels this way, you said because they believe. And that's the thing. There's no intellect involved with this. There's no critical reasoning. There is no actual thought about the process.
Well, I actually handed the Republican candidate for governor the packet of information, which has the facts, as we have discovered with all the research that's been done. And I promise you, our little campaign coordinator, his name is Roy McAmoyle. He sweats over this stuff. He puts in endless hours. He puts in 10, 12, 14, 20-hour days in order to make sure that we have our facts and figures and research is done correctly. We have very, very intelligent people. It seemed that today I was faced with somebody who believed that this wind farm project was dreamed up by two or three people living in the head of the holler and in the west end of Raleigh County. And that's simply not what's going on.
No, this is science.
Yes, this is science. This is absolutely science by highly educated people with lots of research and lots of support. We have support for this particular project to save this mountain and to create green jobs and renewable energy from coast to coast.
And that was the next place I was going, Lorella. If it works on Coal River Mountain, where else can it work in West Virginia? Where else can it work in Appalachia?
Well, I think that's the fear.
I think it is, too.
I think that's the fear. I think, you know, this would be the biggest windmill farm on the East Coast. And there are many, many mountains in the state of West Virginia that we hope to save. They've destroyed over 500 mountaintops throughout Appalachia already, just simply blown the tops over them, off of them, and shoved the leftovers into the valley.
Yeah, how many square miles, if you know, offhand?
That figure I don't have right
okay.
now. I know they've
by the end of the decade, it will equal the same size as the state of Delaware, if I'm not mistaken.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. And, you know, there are many, many mountains that we can still save. This actually is a rainforest throughout Appalachia, and we need to do everything we can to stop the destruction here, because not only are they blowing the tops off the mountains, but in doing so, they're covering our life-giving waters. They are covering the headwaters of the streams. And just this week, within the past couple of weeks, they covered an extra 4.2 miles of stream that we were trying to save very, very quickly. And we had filed a lawsuit, and before we could actually get to court, the streams were already covered. So with the litigation based on saving the stream, once the streams are covered, then there's no point in going to court. And, you know, of course, the press stated that, you know, the union jobs were saved. Well, that's not what the case was about. The case was about saving the streams. And if they continue at this rate, we won't have good drinkable water.
We won't have anywhere to live.
No. We won't have clean air to breathe. The rock dust, the silica, which rains down upon us when they do the explosives, that stuff attaches itself to the inside of your lungs, and it doesn't go away.
Yeah, I believe it causes something called silicosis.
That's what it's called.
Yeah. Basically, eventually it turns one's lungs into concrete.
Mm-hmm. That is what it's called.
It was first identified during the building of the Hawk's Nest Tunnel down here at the foot of our mountain when Gauley Bridge became known as the Town of the Living Dead. It was the worst industrial disaster before Bhopal.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, both perpetrated by Union Carbide, but never mind. Let's go back and review for just a minute, if you don't mind, Lorella, because you touched on something that I believe deserves further examination and further illumination. And that is, we have this myth, and there is no way you can set it up as anything but myth, that all these mountaintop demolition workers, because they're not miners, all these mountaintop demolition workers will have to go on welfare and lose their jobs. Okay? Well, you've already demonstrated that it's not true, that far more good union, benefit-carrying, pension-building, well-paying jobs will be created by the growth of a wind, this wind farm, than people get off of mountaintop removal. That being the case, who are the only people who stand to lose out of this, Lorella?
Well, I believe that this campaign is a win-win. I believe it's good for the community. It's good for the economy. It's good for the county. The county will receive an enormous amount of taxes off this particular project.
Oh, the tax revenues have got to be stunning. Power for 150,000 homes?
150,000 homes. And that's a very, very conservative estimate. Everything you hear us say will be conservative. We have projected between 150,000 and 180,000 homes that this particular wind farm would power. The tax revenue that the state and the county stand to gain. And the only, we have also made a proposal to the primary landowner that, you know, they would stand to make a lot of money, several million dollars a year, by leasing this project for, leasing this land for this particular project. The only one that would stand to lose anything at all would be, of course, the coal company, and I would maintain that their losses wouldn't be that great due to the fact that they can still access the majority of the coal by the traditional coal mining practices. They can still go underground and get it while we are, you know, while we build windmills and get renewable energy on the surface. So I believe it's a win-win. And the fact of the matter is that the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals decision comes down in a manner that would make mountaintop removal very, very difficult or not economically feasible. It would probably be in the best interest of the coal company to allow renewable energy to be produced on the surface. If they can't use it for MTR, why not allow a wind farm to be erected there?
That seems just abundantly sane to me, Lorella. So in the final analysis, it strikes me that it's exactly what you just said. It's a win-win. It might actually inure to the benefit of the coal companies, for heaven's sakes.
Yes. It would be a major public relations stunt for them to relinquish the surface rights while they're still accessing, while they're still making money on coal. Coal is at its highest price ever right now. They can still get the majority of it by going underground, and through litigation, it may just not be, it may not be feasible to do MTR. We are hoping that it would not be, we're hoping that mountaintop removal would be against the law.
Well, let me ask you one more thing, Lorella, if you don't mind me, please. You mentioned 150 to 180,000 homes being powered off this wind farm. Where are those homes?
Those homes are all over the state.
They're in West Virginia? It's going to be power for West Virginia?
A lot of it will be power for West Virginia. The power that comes from this particular wind farm will be part of it, will be shipped out just like through transmission lines, just like the coal is shipped out. The majority of the coal that's mined in the state of West Virginia, of course, is not kept in the state of West Virginia. It is shipped to other states. It's shipped to other countries. We put it on barges and send it down the river, and then we put it on ships and put it on the ocean and send it to China and lots of other places. And the electricity from this particular wind project would be similar. Part of it would not remain in the state.
Okay, but there would be, beyond the jobs themselves, there would finally be an opportunity for somebody like me who very badly wants to use green energy to make the horn go.
Absolutely.
That could very well be available to me.
Absolutely, and the governor has the power to do this. The governor, Governor Joe Manchin, has stated publicly that he believes that renewables need to be a part of the mix, that he would support renewable energy, and if he means what he says, we have the perfect project for him. And we do plan to approach his office about that within the next few days.
Okay, so are you saying that there hasn't been an official reaction yet?
From the governor?
Right.
No, there has not.
Okay.
We have tried for several weeks to actually get a face-to-face with the governor. And we met with the head of the Economic Development Committee. We played phone tag with the schedulers for quite some time. There were a few days that they didn't return our calls. We had people actually walk into the office and try to schedule a meeting. And I think that just exhausted other excuses. And finally, I got his head scheduler on the phone, and she referred me to one of his aides. And I do believe that this meeting, after all this time, will be with one of his aides. I'm hoping that he will show up. It would be nice if he would show up. But
he might show a little respect, at least in an election year.
That would be nice. Yeah, that would be nice, especially since I met with his opponent this morning. Yeah, it might be nice if he would show, you know, stand by his commitment to support renewables. It would be nice if he would actually show up at a meeting. And he's going to have many opportunities to do that in the next few weeks. And then by the middle of September, if he's not very supportive of this, we're going to be at his doorstep. We plan to be on the steps of the Capitol on the 16th day of September for a major rally in Charleston. And we are going to ask the governor to come out and support, straight out come out in support of this particular project.
What about, and if you don't know, it's okay, what about my congressman? What about, I think he's probably your congressman, too, Nick Rahal.
Well, I have actively pursued a meeting with Nikki Jo Rahal. And the last meeting that I had with Mr. Rahal pertaining to the Clean Water Protection Act did not go well. I have been on the phone. I spent one whole day going back and forth on the phone with his offices, both in locally and in D.C., and finally his head scheduler, Vicki Vandy, told me that she could give me a tentative date for an appointment with the congressman, and more than likely it won't be with the congressman, it'll be with Nate, a tentative date to meet with the congressman the end of September. And I said, I'll take it.
Sure. Let me just ask you, and I'm not trying to, some of this is speculation, Lorella, but What do we have to do to get past these people's blind spots about coal? I mean, you've got the numbers. The jobs aren't there. Because whenever you start talking about mountaintop removal, and you've experienced it more than I have, well, you hear, well, you know, it brings us jobs to West Virginia. Well, the numbers don't add up.
Well,
what do we got to do to get past it, or you know, change their hearts or whatever?
What we've been trying to do throughout this campaign, we have been on the ground every day pounding the pavement. And what we have tried to do throughout this is we have tried to get the facts into the hands of the people that we believe have the power to influence this campaign. And that was the primary reason for my meeting this morning with the former Senator Weeks, who's now running for governor. I tried several times to reach Mr. Weeks, and he did not return my call. And finally, when someone that knew both of us got him on the phone last week and asked him to speak to me, he finally did agree to a meeting this morning, but a meeting with only me, nobody else from Cold River, not even our little campaign coordinator, whom he doesn't even know. He finally did agree to a meeting with me, and I was very, very thankful for that, because the purpose of this meeting was to get the information in his hands. Because the problem with not making any progress here is the fact that there is so much misinformation out there. You know, his position was, all of those people down there want to stop coal mining altogether. And, you know, I informed him that, you know, I am, you know, I can't speak for anybody else, but what I'm here about is green jobs, renewable energy, a sustainable future. We are desperate for some type of economic development where we live, and we believe that we have to start preparing for the post-coal future, and we have to transition off of coal. And this is the start. This is the beginning. And but there's just so much information. There's so much fallacy out there that's being tossed around, and people believe what they want to believe. And, you know, his comment was, you know, that this campaign shouldn't be based on emotion. And I informed him that in his hand was not emotion. That was all fact and figures and science. And if he would bother, which he hadn't at that point, he hadn't looked at it at that point, which he hadn't looked at. And I'm hoping that, you know, he will take the time. I know he's very, very busy campaigning, trying to become the next governor. But I hope that at some point he'll sit down and look at the information, and we have much more science and studies and information to be produced. We've commissioned a couple of economic impact studies by a firm out of Morgantown, West Virginia, called Downstream Strategies, and they're going to do a couple of economic impact studies. These will be the first of their kind, and it will actually show the good things and the bad things, the pros and cons of a mountaintop removal against sustainable energy and the wind farm, how much money can be made off of MTR and how much money can be made off of renewable energy or the wind farm, how much what the environmental impacts are, the impacts on the environment and the impacts on the community by doing MTR as opposed to a wind farm. And
well, what could I ask you something else, Arella, please? What about the environmental impact of doing wind farms as opposed to, say, this coal-to-liquids thing that apparently you and I as West Virginia citizens are going to wind up paying for?
Well, we're already sinking a couple hundred million dollars into that. And, but I think that'll be in there. They're going to cover just about every aspect of the coal story as opposed to wind farms. They're going to be very, very thorough in this. And I think these two studies will be very, very helpful, if people bother to read them. You know, all of this means nothing if you don't read it, if you don't look at it, if you don't try to understand it, if you just choose to stand back in your ignorance and go, they want my job. You know, if you choose to maintain that stance as opposed to looking at the facts. We have to start doing something here. We have to, it's not okay. It's not okay for the people who live here, and it's not just me, there are hundreds of people here whose lives are devastatingly impacted by mountaintop removal. And there are people that we know that are sick, dead, and dying because of the impacts of things that are going on here. All of the wildlife, all of the vegetation, all of the forest, everything that is in the path of a coal company doing mountaintop removal is completely destroyed forever. Once you totally destroy a mountain, you cannot put it back. It's like putting a mountain, it's like throwing it in a mixmaster and then trying to throw it back on the side of the mountain. It just cannot be done. You can't put it back.
Well, you and I have both been to Cayford Mountain, and we know what the reclamation looks like with the the blasted rock that sticks up out of the earth. There's no way you could ever farm anything there. You can't grow anything there. The water table is gone. The life, the wildlife is gone. A crow flying across has to pack a lunch. It's a dead zone.
Yeah.
It's a moonscape with a little crummy grass growing on it.
Well, right now, because we have no rain predicted here for quite a few days, I'm not even having my grass mowed. And the reason I'm not having my grass mowed is because with the grass taller, it's going to hold the moisture in the ground. And it makes sense that when they strip those trees off the top of the mountains, you know, it holds no moisture in there anymore. It's just baked, and it is a moonscape. Nothing will grow on it. Les Badiza, you know, will just about grow on concrete, and it's not native grass. The deer won't eat it. I mean, we have so much for people.
Wait, the deer won't eat it?
The deer won't eat it.
That daggummit, Lorella, I mean, you know, you love a garden as much as I do. I've had deer come into my garden and eat my hot peppers down to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
The deer won't eat that grass?
Les Badiza, it's not native to this area. Now, you can see commercials on TV where, you know, the people who make the machines that help to destroy the mountain, they have this grassy area, and I would assume that they, you know, hold a deer captive off from the side of the camera.
Oh yeah, there's a little production dude with a pair of headphones on,
yeah.
And the director whispers
yeah,
into his microphone, cue the deer.
Yeah, now, yes. And, you know, they're pretending as though this is a wonderful place for them to live, but...
Oh, and then we know that the animated bugs just love it.
Yeah. And, but, no, it is just this total destruction, you know, for the people who oppose windmill farms, you know, as far as the arguments. There are several arguments there. One, of course, is the view shed, and I would say that I will trade my view shed of a mountaintop removal site any day to their view shed of looking at a wind turbine on top of a mountain.
Yeah, they haven't seen one, have they?
No, probably not. But the fact of the matter is the majority of these particular turbines, no one will ever see. It's like the mountaintop removal at Kayford Mountain. You literally have to drive straight up the side of a mountain a very long time in order to get there to view the devastation of the mountaintop removal. Well, that will be the case with the majority of these wind turbines. Most people will never, ever see these. It's not going to be like this huge windmill field, you know, that goes on for miles and miles and miles, or the things are growing out of the ground. It's not going to be like that. And for the birds and bats theory, those who...
Now, I got a cat that works over the birds pretty good.
Right. And house cats have been proven to kill more birds than wind turbines do. And bats, of course, you know, we're all concerned about bats, but I would maintain that through the process of mountaintop removal, all of the wildlife is destroyed, not just the bats, their habitats destroyed, not just the birds, but the bear and the deer and the raccoon and the foxes.
Oh, when you create a place that a turkey can't even forage, you really have gone into moonscape.
You know, it's all totally destroyed. And for people who are concerned about birds and bats, I would ask them also to start thinking about the bears that are covered up in their caves with their babies still in there when they push the stuff over the side of the mountains, and they're left there to starve to death.
You know, we talk a little bit about coalition building on this show from time to time, Lorella. What about animal, not just environmental, but what about animal rights activist groups? Do they know what happens to the wildlife on a mountaintop removal site?
Well, you know, several months ago, PETA awarded our senator, Bird, an award, and because of work that he's done for animal rights. And there were more than a few of us here in the coalfield of southern West Virginia that caused a major uprising with PETA because we informed him of what he was allowing to happen here. And
good.
We actually have an audio tape of a mama bear and baby bear crying out, covered up in their cave, and no way to get to them. You could hear the screaming. And And those are the kind of things that
that we
made sure that PETA was aware of. I'm sure there are, but their Appalachians seem to be expendable. We had a
second-class citizens? Third-class?
And I didn't really realize that, Bob, until we had a film crew here back in March, and the woman, the producer of this particular film crew, she said that she used to work for CBS, and when she worked for CBS, she knew that she knew better than to do any type of show, any type of documentary about the American Indian. And the reason she did not was nobody would watch, nobody cared. And it's the same thing here in Appalachia. You know, we're equal with that, although I'm also part American Indian.
Sure.
But it's the same mentality here in Appalachia. You don't do any media about the people in Appalachia because nobody will listen and nobody will watch and nobody will care. And we are expendable, and very, very few people really understand the price that we pay here when you turn your lights on and when you plug in your iPod and you plug in your cell phone and you turn your computer on. Very little people understand when the former senator today was spoke about the cost of coal. You know, I informed him that there was no way that he could measure the true cost of coal, judging from where I sit, because the price that we pay, you can't measure that. And I have said many times, we don't live where they mine coal. They mine coal where we live. The place that I live on, and I'm not unlike many, many other people throughout Appalachia, the property here goes back generations. My husband it's been in my husband's family for many, many generations. My husband's buried in the cemetery next door. There's a freshwater stream that runs by my house. I raised my children in this home. My husband died while we were living together in this home. He died of black lung. All of the memories that we shared together are here. It's a very peaceful place, fruit trees throughout the backyard, which we're going to make apple butter soon.
Yes, we are.
It's a very, very peaceful place, and I would like to say that I believe that we all should have the right to do whatever we want on our own property, but the coal companies cannot do, as long, we should have the right to do whatever we want on our own property as long as it's not illegal and we don't affect our neighbor. The coal companies cannot do mountaintop removal, first of all, without affecting me and hundreds of other people throughout Appalachia, without impacting our lives with the blasting, our homes shaking, the foundations cracking, the windows rattling.
The wells destroyed and poisoned.
Yeah. Yeah, the wells sunk, poisoned, contaminated, destroyed, the air that we breathe being contaminated. Now, the forest being destroyed, the access to gathering of herbs, ginseng, the vegetation, the wildlife being destroyed. They have a right to do what they want on their own land as long as they're not affecting their neighbor. They can't do this without affecting me and hundreds of other people throughout Appalachia.
I seem to recall an old saying that went something like, your rights end where my nose begins.
Uh-huh.
You ever heard that?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And it, you know, it doesn't seem to bother them to ravage a cemetery, to mine all the way around it or underneath it. Or, you know, I know one particular guy who lives on Cave Ford Mountain that, and there are lots of people here who have to do this, that actually has to sign a release form. He has to don a hard hat, and he has to take safety training, and in order to try to get to his family cemetery, and then sometimes they won't allow him to do that, he has to get permission to go visit his dead relatives. Now, when they come, when they ask me to sign a consent form to go visit my husband's grave, I'm not sure how well behaved I'm going to be on that day.
I don't think anybody could very well expect you to be well-behaved on that day or any day thereafter.
There are many, many people here who have to do that, who have to do that.
And we're and you know, you talk about property being in the family for generations and things like that, Lorella. We're talking about those generations lying on those hillsides.
Why is it okay? Well, it
brings jobs. And see, I hear something like that, Lorella, and I just want to pull my fingernails out of the ceiling when I hear that. It brings jobs. So as long as we get jobs, we can, let me see, desecrate the final resting place of our loved ones. We can turn a temperate rainforest into a dead zone. We can kill the streams that provide water for the rest of the eastern United States. Is that what it is? Is it a catch-all now that as long as we say, well, it brings jobs, that it's okay?
Well, so do drug dealers and pimps.
Yeah.
So did Hitler.
Yeah, lots of jobs.
You know, it's the fact of the matter is, it's not okay. You know, we have people here who say, I'm just trying to feed my family. Well, if you're just trying to feed your family, then stop poisoning your neighbor, because it's not okay. You know, and there are so many people here who work in the coal mines because we live in a mono economy. This is the only decent paying jobs that there are around here, and I lay that at the feet of our legislators. I know.
How can you not?
I know with everything in me that there are men on those MTR sites that if they had a good, decent paying job with good benefits, that other than blowing the top off the mountain, that they would take the other choice, that they wouldn't be up there destroying the place where they live. And granted, some of them don't live in the immediate area, but there are people here who do live there. And it's a mono economy. It's the only thing that's offered here. I've been in the offices pleading with the politicians, with Senator Byrd, with Senator Rockefeller, with Congressman Rahal. I've been in their offices pleading for something to change in southern West Virginia. And they don't listen. You know why? Because it's exactly what you said. Jobs.
And it's a myth.
And it's a myth.
It's like saying, well, there is little difference, Lorella, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but there is little difference between saying, well, we can't stop mountaintop removal because it means jobs, and saying, well, we can't stop mountaintop removal because the Easter Bunny won't come anymore. They're both based on myths, aren't they?
You're right. Because if the politicians, if the powers that be would offer alternatives here, then there would be a choice. There would be a choice. I can assure you that there are people on those sites that would take a clean, sustainable, long-lasting, renewable alternative if they could, if it was a good paying job, if they could take care of their families on that. You know, because this is not, you know, there's a few arrogant guys out there, yeah, that, you know, but you have that in any situation. But the majority of these guys are out there trying to make a living, and this is all they've got, and our politicians won't, because of the big money that the Coal Association has, the politicians won't listen to any alternative. When we went to Rockefeller's office, his aide started the conversation by saying, the senator won't support a bill that will stop mountaintop removal. That's the way he started the conversation. He never listened to anything we said. That's the way he started the conversation.
Then that's not a conversation.
No, it's not. Well, we did have a conversation. Wasn't pleasant, but we did have a conversation. And, you know, Rahal did basically the same thing, except he did it in a louder tone. Rahal proceeded to...
Wait, your own congressman yelled at you?
Yes, he did, for about 45 minutes, me and about eight other of his constituents. And when we actually showed him a picture of rust-colored water coming out of a faucet and into the sink of one of our neighbors, he tossed it back across his desk and said, water's like that throughout southern West Virginia, meaning it's okay.
Was he asserting that, you know, that the water would be that way even without the mountaintop removal?
Didn't assert anything. He just tossed it back across the desk and implied that, you know, that's just the way it is. Live with it. That's just the way it is.
You know, you've gotten out, and am I taking up too much of your time, Lorella?
No.
Okay. You've gotten out and about. We've traveled together. you've seen how the rest of the world lives. There's a there is a sweet difference between being here and being somewhere else, but there's also a very real negative difference between living here and living somewhere else. Southern West Virginia, Mingo County, McDowell County, Wyoming County, what's there besides the mountaintop removal jobs?
Nothing.
I mean, whether it's schools, hospitals, access to health care, being able to go to the grocery store without spending $30 on gasoline.
Well, they've closed the majority of the schools in McDowell County in order to build a in order to build a school on a reclaimed, quote unquote, reclaimed mountaintop removal site. And there are major problems with the foundation of that school. Of course, it cracks a little bit more every day.
Just like the prison in Kentucky.
Just like Sink Sink, absolutely. And the prison in Kentucky. And now what they are planning to do in Mingo County is they have implemented the local Board of Education, who the people who live there, the people who, you know, have their neighbors there, the people who love the place, refused to go along with the countywide consolidation. So the state came in and took control, appointed their own, you know, head guy in charge, and implemented the closure proceedings anyway. You want to know why? So they could close all of the high schools, and they could bus all the kids in the county back on top of a mountain on a reclaimed mining site so the coal company wouldn't have to abide by SMCRA and reclaim the land. If they can donate the land to the local Board of Education, then they can save millions of dollars on the infrastructure, on the water lines, on the power lines, on rebuilding, on the roads to get to that. The coal companies don't have to pay for that. We do. The taxpayers of the state of West Virginia do. Oh, and the taxpayers all over the nation do, too, because some of that's federal money. And that way the coal company doesn't have to pay for it. We all get.
You know, it takes a lot to make me speechless, Sorrell. I mean, I've always got something. And
that's a fact. They set aside $18 million to build that school down there, and they can't build it for that.
You know, you bring all this up, and you remind me, you know, a few weeks ago, David K. Johnston, the author, was in both Beckley and down in Institute at West Virginia
and
State.
He was at Kayford.
And he was at Kayford, exactly. But the first night he was here, when he was down at Institute at the campus of West Virginia State, that was the night that Don Blankenship showed up.
Mm-hmm. With the bulge in his back pocket.
Yeah, exactly.
The Supreme Court.
Yeah. Because Brent Benjamin's pretty big. It takes a lot to stuff him into it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Spike Maynard and Robin Davis.
Mm-hmm.
But he showed up, and the first question out of the gate, when the question and answer session started, was because he'd been talking about corporate socialism. That's the term David uses. They said, well, you know, is big coal and mountaintop removal part of this? And, you know, bless his heart, he was honest. He said, I haven't researched that yet, so I can't give you an answer. But when he sees numbers like this, how can he not say that the so-called King Coal isn't part of the problem?
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. All you have to do is take a drive through most of the towns throughout southern West Virginia, and you will see the prosperity, the myth of the prosperity that coal brings. You can drive through your little town. You can drive through my town. Now, granted, the area where you live flourishes due to the tourism, but they are also they're going after the mountains in your county, too.
And we're not exactly doing a lot of flourishing. A bunch of parents here, you mentioned schools, a bunch of parents up the road here at a little place called Nuttall just made the, and I don't fault them for this, the state wanted to close down their little middle school and make all their kids have two-hour bus rides to come down to our middle school. And the State Board of Education, talking about being penny-wise and pound-foolish, they spent, the county and the state spent $250,000 taxpayer dollars trying to force these parents to send their children down to this middle school. And then they relented last Thursday.
Why not? It's not their money. It's not their money, it's our money. See, a big part of the problem here is they can make stupid decisions like that because there's no ramifications for them. There's no price for them to pay. We get to pay it. Why not?
Sure, it's the life serial equivalent of government. You know, let's get Mikey. You know what I mean? You remember the Mikey commercials? Yeah, let's get the citizens. They'll pay for it. They pay for everything.
That's right. It's like the governor of the state of West Virginia spent $975,000 of taxpayers' money fighting the CEO of Massey Energy, and then all of a sudden he's walking around with a Friends of Coal sticker on his shirt. It wasn't his money. It wasn't his nearly $1 million. It was ours. He had nothing to lose. So he does what he wants.
Free money.
Free money. Free lunch.
Hard to stomach. Well, we have run all over creation, Lorella, and I really appreciate the time you've taken. Let's sort of bring this full circle. What happens with the kickoff tomorrow?
With the kickoff tomorrow, well, we've notified a lot of media about this. It's been in the newspapers. It's on the radio stations. It's on the TV stations. We have drive time ads running. I did an interview with one of the local channels, one of the local TV stations this afternoon. There are more calling for tomorrow. There's a launch going out nationwide. We're going to reach at least a million people tomorrow. We'll know about this. And we would like for everybody who cares about the water that they drink and the air that they breathe and the future for their children to go online and support the Coal River Wind Farm. It's at coalriverwind.org, and this can be the beginning of the transition for Appalachia to a just and sustainable future.
I can't express, Lorella, how much I love this idea, because there's a certain satisfying unity to it.
This is probably one of the most radical things that you could propose, is a windmill farm smack dab in the middle of coal country, and that's what we're doing.
But it also has a roundness to it, if you know what I mean, because Appalachia has provided the power that has run this country for as long as there has been this country. Jeff Biggers, our good friend, has pointed that out via his wonderful book, The United States of Appalachia. He's pointed it out via the various essays and blog postings that he makes. Appalachia has powered America, and that has largely been through coal.
That's right.
And now we have a chance for Appalachia to power America again, but without Appalachia and Appalachians having to pay an overt physical price in blood and sweat and toil and human agony, death, and misery.
I believe the only reason that we have not implemented renewable energies to this point now, I used to live in Southern California right next to a very, very large windmill farm, and that was 20 years ago, which speaks to the fact that this is not new technology. But the fact of the matter is, in the state of West Virginia, they own the coal, they own the mountains, and they own the mineral rights, therefore they can make money off it. They don't own the wind.
You forgot something. They own the pot, they own the government, too.
Yeah, they own the government, too. But they don't own the wind, and that's the reason it's been such a major, major struggle. And we need to start now. We would encourage everybody to sign the online petition, support this campaign. The 16th day of September, the 5th of the Capitol in Charleston, West Virginia, we are having a rally, and we would like to have people from all over the country show up at that rally and demand that the governor of the state of West Virginia implement this particular plan, get behind this, and do something to change the poverty in the state of West Virginia and the Appalachian people who are being sacrificed for the energy needs of the rest of the nation.
West Virginia is a beautiful place in the earliest days of autumn. You and I both know that. Mm-hmm. And September 16th would be a lovely time, no matter where you are in this country, to take a little drive. I constantly say on this program, stand shoulder to shoulder, to manifest the real, honest-to-God, physical aspect of standing shoulder to shoulder with people who won't take no for an answer, who are gonna struggle to create a sustainable West Virginia, in the face of daunting odds, but also in the face or having on their side reason, common sense, and most importantly, the facts. So you're absolutely right. If you got a little time, if you did whatever, come on down September the 16th, and we'll make sure that the information gets out, Lorella, and maybe we will have some folks standing shoulder to shoulder
great.
With us.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bob.
Lorella, you take care, and thanks again, and best of luck tomorrow.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Lorella Scarborough from Coal River Mountain Watch, dear friend of mine. And you know what? Whether you realize it or not, a dear friend of yours. This is about standing up. This is about not just talking about the future, but trying to make the future happen. Not sometime off in a fuzzy, hazy distance. But right now, it can happen. And you know, for these people, Lorella mentioned the viewscape. And the people go, I don't want the viewscape pollution. I didn't spend all my money to come here and have to look at windmills. I want to look at the mountains. Well, you know, dumbass, the mountains are going to be gone if they get all blown up. Where's your viewscape going to be then? Sorry, I'm just a little bit of a, you know, nasty guy that way. But beyond that, I keep thinking back. In fact, I have paintings, watercolors, that hang on our walls here. And I found them in an antique shop for next to nothing eons ago. They've got those old sort of Victorian-looking gilt frames around them. They're fairly big. And they are portrayal, they're pictures, paintings of windmills in low country. And the last I checked, the windmills in the Netherlands, and our listeners in the Netherlands can either tell me I'm crazy, or they can say, yep, Bob, you got it there, because we've got listeners in the Netherlands. Last I checked, those are big tourist draws. They really are. And I wouldn't have any problem in planting some dadgum tulips around the wind farm. Sure, why not? Make it a tourist destination. Set up a viewing area, because they are, it's monumental stuff, and it is stunningly, it's just breathtaking to see it at work. In the chat room, I'm asked, what is a viewscape? A viewscape is what you get when you buy land where you want to be able to look out your picture window and see, for instance, a pastoral landscape. And the AstroTurf groups in West Virginia, and there are some of them, who oppose wind farms say, well, that creates viewscape pollution. Viewscape pollution. I kid you not. That somehow the scene will be less tranquil and less pastoral if there are windmills involved. Again, I reference the Netherlands. It's not less pastoral or beautiful because of their windmills. How is it? It would be with these. Never mind the fact that you can't see them. There's nobody who owns property that would be able to see them. But still, they talk about their viewscape pollution, Muffy. I think you know where that kind of stuff comes from. I think it's fairly obvious where that kind of stuff comes from. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, this is Juanita.
Hey, Juanita, how are you?
I'm fine. That's stunning, stunning, stunning.
What an exciting project. Say again, please.
I said, I want her for president.
Yeah, I tell you what, Lorella is a force of nature.
She sure is, and she knows how to say it, and then it means something, you know, and she doesn't have to holler. I'm just telling you, I'm just hoping and praying for y'all to get something better. It's the disgrace what's been going on all these years.
It is. It
and,
is.
You know, they're talking about seeing the windmills. What about all the power lines and stuff like that? They're not that beautiful.
No, but they sure do like for them to come into their home there that's got the beautiful viewscape.
Yeah. But, well, it's just like down here, they're planning on building this $1 billion, I don't know if I think they said $5 or $6 billion, nuclear plant. And yet, our...
Boy, now there's some viewscape pollution, Juanita. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh, no.
See that big old mushroom cloud-shaped cooling tower?
And pay for it.
Oh, yeah. And, well, it's the same Dodge, and that's what David K. Johnston keeps talking about. We wind up being the ones who pay for these boondoggles.
Yeah.
You know,
but, it's not...
Nuke plants.
It's not just
and,
outrageous. It's cruel and inhuman to treat people like that.
It is.
You know, and animals.
It's and she said it so well, Lorella did. I don't live where you mine coal. You mine coal where I live.
I live. Boy, I tell you. I just hope that, well, I don't think Doolally would listen, but I just hope that Obama will listen to y'all. I tell you.
Well, I do, too. And
and by the way, we got to notice that they're going to raise our rates down here.
Well, sure. You've got stockholders to support. Oh, mercy sakes. Are you going to is the hurricane bearing down on you where you are, Juanita?
It's headed this way.
In fact, you remind me, I need to make a program announcement. Guy James says that he will not be live tomorrow as he doesn't expect to have any electricity by showtime tomorrow.
That's what I'm worried about. You know, it's got like the same path that Charlie has.
Oh, really?
Remember that one in 94?
Yes.
That was the first one. But it's not as powerful. Right now it's like 60 miles an hour. And when it comes on land, it usually weakens. So I'm just hoping. That's all I can do.
Well, exactly, and that's the nature of the power grid is such that you don't have to have 110 mile an hour winds. All you got to have is one good, miserable, poorly rooted white pine that goes across a transformer somewhere, and everybody gets screwed. And so
we just had to cut down a tree in this vacant lot. We have these trees down here that grow real fast, but they're shallow rooted. And it kept falling over. They split apart, too. And they fall over in my yard and on my tool shed and stuff, you know, and didn't do a lot of damage, but could have.
Sure.
And so anyway, I don't know if we get in trouble about that, but by golly. But these trees, you know, people don't know it. And the people that own the property there and down in Miami, and they don't know, so we have to live with those trees. And they're right, you know, next to our neighbors, too, you know, that they're just those real quick-growing trees, and there's about three different kinds of them. And you think, oh, that's great. But if you know about
them. Well, they're white pines, and they're pulp trees, and they blow over at a hard look.
This is have you ever heard of ear trees?
What kind?
Ear. That's one of them.
Like E-A-R, ear?
Uh-huh. Yeah, they've got pods shaped like an ear.
No, okay, I'm in uncharted territory. well, at least I've got something to do with the Google once the show's over.
That's
I'm going to go find me
one
some.
That's kind of them. There's others. They've got one of them has got beautiful flowers. So they just send seeds everywhere. We've got seeds all over the place coming up. And if you don't take care of it, they'll just grow. And that's what happened next door. The people are not here to take care of it, and, you know. But anyway, it's just a lot of things. It's about time that we the people some way can rise up and take control of our country. It's just getting more and more ridiculous. We have a little store out close to me, and I go out there and I get ice and stuff, and he's just the nicest person. I found out he's from Lebanon. He's been over here 7 years. And he says, he said to David, I said, what do you think about the hurricane? And he said, I hate the hurricane. Then he said, no, I don't hate it. I don't like them. He said, hate is a bad word. I said, I know it, but you know, I said, I'm getting close to hating some of the people in this country that are causing such heartaches. You know, everywhere, when you study the history of this guy that, who's in charge, everything he touches turns to dust.
Yes, it does. All his life.
And he comes out smelling like a rose.
Sure does.
And he's doing damage over here. We haven't seen what can happen yet over here. But we can look over at, we can look right here at New Orleans.
Sure we can. And looky there, we're coming up on the, third anniversary of Katrina?
Yeah.
And it's still a disaster area?
This month, I think. This is the month.
Yeah, the 31st of August is third anniversary.
And I'll tell you, it's just heartbreaking the way people are treated. It's just not right. We got to do something.
Well, indeed, I do believe so. And I wanted to ask you, Juanita, did you watch the Obama-McCain thingamajig?
No, I didn't. I didn't know anything about it, and I didn't watch it. I didn't, you know, do you think it'd be worth watching?
Well, it's over. I mean, it happened Saturday night.
But I mean a rerun.
I think you would find it interesting.
Okay.
There's Obama giving measured, considered answers to the questions, and John McCain is so chomping at the bit when he comes on, it's like he's had the questions in advance and knows what Obama's answers were.
Yeah.
It was so transparent and so obvious, and it turns out, we were talking about at the beginning of the show with Susan, turns out, what's his name, Rick Warren, purpose-driven Warren or whatever.
Uh-huh.
His first statement to McCain was, how was the cone of silence? Because he was supposed to be in a soundproof booth. I think that was part of the myth, part of the dodge. And he said, and it turns out, for the first half hour, he wasn't even there. He wasn't even on site, wasn't even on premises.
Yeah. Well, more lies.
Well, so they do that. Look, you stay with your strong suit. You do what you're good at.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Afraid to do.
sadly. Well, Juanita, it's good to hear from you. Do you have to batten down the hatches or anything before Faye hits?
I'm hoping everything will stand up. I don't have anything to batten down the hatches.
Yeah,
we made it 3-3 and before, so maybe God willing, we'll make it through this one.
Hopefully it'll just be an ugly rainstorm.
Yeah. You just never know.
No, you don't. Well, do take care and make sure that we hear from you when that thing crosses up your way.
And I know you may not like this, but I'm going to pray for you about that.
Well, no, hey, I've never told anybody not to pray. Wait a minute, I never said I don't like it. No, you don't have to worry about that.
Because I have had prayers answered.
If that's what works, we will take them as the book says in abundance.
It will surprise you sometimes. It took me a long time.
We'll take them pressed down, shaken together, and in abundance, Juanita.
Okay.
All right.
Gotcha. Okay.
You take
God
care.
God bless you, and God bless that lady, Miss Garner.
Lorella, absolutely. Lorella.
Lorella?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a nice name.
It is.
She's a great lady.
She is something, I promise you. And in person, even more so.
Yeah.
So we'll talk to you soon, Juanita, and stay safe, all right?
Okay.
Make sure we hear back quick as it's
okay.
Over. All right. Bye now.
Bye.
All right. Bye. Juanita and Guy, both with a sort of a hurricane, or hopefully by then it's just a tropical storm bearing down on them. Let's keep it rolling. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. How's it going?
Hey, Gene. What's up?
Well, I didn't watch the Brokeback Saddleback, whatever that was, because I was too pissed off about the Air Force.
About the Air Force?
Yeah, I didn't just see, I think I sent this to you, and I only put it up on the site. I'm not at the chat room right now, but they've made a commitment to coal liquefaction, and what's more, this is what really gets me. I know this is a new thing, but basically what they're going to be doing, they're going to try and get our allies to do the same thing, and this is the part I don't get. They want to go ahead and do this with the civilian trucking industry as well. They're going to try and push this industry going and all this stuff. And it's funny because it's like, I mean, I can kind of see, assuming they actually know how to make the jet fuel, I can kind of see the logic in that. I don't like it because they can't sequester it. But I can kind of see the logic in it because the country has enemies and all that jazz. And I can kind of see the logic for the make our allies do this. But again, the trucking industry, I can't see logic for this. I mean, the logic I can't see is they want to all do this in private hands.
It's gonna be a free market miracle.
Oh,
and the miracle for the free market is that they're not gonna have to spend any money and that we're gonna be on the hook for all of it.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm thinking, gee, this kind of makes me think like, oh, gee, they're setting up an air wing for Blackwater, you know?
Sure.
Nothing
is beyond the realm of possibility with this crowd.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Anything is possible. And I'm not surprised. You said mad at the Air Force, and frankly, I just needed to know which sort of the column A, column B, or column C. We've seen it coming for a long time, because over toward Beckley, there is a nice little golf resort. Okay, it's it's called Glade Springs.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe Nanette in the chat room can tell me how long ago it was. But they had a big old highfalutin conference, and Jay Rockefeller was there, and the governor was there, and Congressman Ray Hall was there, and everybody who was anybody with mountaintop removal was there, and they had a whole bunch of Air Force brass there to shove down their throats the idea of running. Yeah, Nanette says it was last summer, so it was about a year ago, and it was this whole thing about ramming liquid coal down the Air Force's throats. Oh, your jets will fly a lot better on liquid coal. And so it's not surprising to see something like this prop up that they would, you know, because the pressure has been applied.
Well, it makes me think of two things. I wonder, number one, does Mr. Dobson have any interest in coal mining company, perhaps? And number two, you mentioned earlier in the program about McCain wanting to renegotiate the water rights. And, why is he doing that now? That's a new one on me. I hadn't heard about that. And, by the way, I also wanted to let you know, I didn't put this up. I put this somewhere else. Let's see if I can find it. There's a new dodge out for the wind farm industry about people don't want the wind farms close to the houses because it's the low frequency vibration makes them sick. Supposedly.
Oh.
And apparently if you're within 2 miles of it, because there's a whole thing going on down in Southern Oregon and Boardman about these neighbors are all up in the air, and of course there's the same old viewscape crap. So that'll be the new dot.
Yeah, and there. they're standing there complaining about it into their cell phone that's rotting their brain. Yeah.
And there is... I'll see if I can find it, because there's another... You mentioned to
Lorella. Lorella, yeah.
Earlier about, they don't own the wind. Well, not yet, but they're talking about it.
Huh?
Yeah, there was an article, this is all this wind farms and stuff are saying has brought the question, who owns the wind? And so you can bet that they might want to, I'll find the article and send it on to you. It might take me a few hours, but I'll find it.
One of these days, this idea of being able to own everything is going to catch up with us, Gene.
It's already caught up with us. I just wanted to catch up with them. I mean, it's like, I feel like I've gotten so, it's like, I have no problem with socialism. The only thing I have is, like, it gets misapplied to the people who don't need it. Anyway, well.
And that's what David K. Johnston is talking about when he calls it corporate socialism. They get the socialism. We get the free market.
Oh, isn't that lovely? Anyway, I when I read that on Saturday night, I was like, I was just so angry. So,
sort of brought out your inner Homer Simpson. Don't!
So lucky. It was more like my inner, well, never mind, Agent Fred. Okay, legal turbulence in Germany. Who owns the wind? Of course, it's in Germany now, but, you know, that'll change, I'm sure. Let me see. Here, let me just zip it on over. And that should be now in the chat room. So,
okey-doke.
Enjoy. And it was a great show. So,
well, there's an hour left of it.
Oh, I know, but it was a great piece of this show. So I'll be listening. I'll just probably won't be around too much.
Okie doke. Well, Gene, good hearing from you, brother.
Good to hear from you, too.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. So, wow. The owner... There's a line from a Jimmy Buffett song. Yeah, I know. It's always a Jimmy Buffett song, isn't it? Yes, it is. And the line is, one night they put a price on the sunset. And that's what we're talking about, isn't it? Gotta try to find a way to make a buck off of... Because we own it. It's ours. You see what I'm saying? And let me just present you with for comparison and contrast purposes. Now, I've told you time and time again about all of these weird right wing interview pitches that I receive. Okay? So I got another one here. Every now and then I get one of these. It's somebody wanting me to bring on this right-wing investment freak named Arthur Alley. Or maybe it's Arthur Ally. He's the president of something called the Timothy Plan. And the Timothy Plan is an investment portfolio dodge, a mutual fund company, if you will. They're according to the description, that selects stocks it promotes based on that company's values. And right now, the head of the Timothy Plan is all kinds of bent out of shape at McDonald's. Now, McDonald's hasn't said anything to this Arthur Alley, whatever. This is just a shameless attempt to get free PR out, once again, riding on the LGBT community's backs. McDonald's appears to be seeking growth by continuing to reach out to the homosexual community. Recently, it paid $20,000 to become a member of the National Gay and Lesbian Chamber of Commerce. As president of the Timothy Plan, I read you that part, but he said, ours is a company that believes in a certain set of values that should not be compromised. And McDonald's apparently disagrees with us. Therefore, none of the portfolios we offer will include stock in McDonald's. So, let's review.
McDonald's was okay to have in the portfolio until they joined the National Gay and Lesbian Chamber of Commerce, despite the fact that practically everything McDonald's sells is in one way, shape, form, or fashion poison. Okay? Okay. So, poison, okay. Poison and trying to engage in some diversity with the LGBT community. Bad, bad. Unchristian. Can't be part of the Timothy Plan. And I generally don't like to give these wing nuts like this huckster Arthur Alley. I don't like to give him any time on the air, and I'm not gonna. Couldn't make me. Won't do it. But it would almost be worth it to ask him, one, that question. McDonald's, you know, hormone beef, they tried, until they got caught, they were ready to give us, you know, Franken spud fries, you know, with the little goat stomach gene inside it. Go ask Morgan Spurlock what the McDonald's diet will do to you. Okay? So you'd like to ask him that, but the next thing you'd like to ask him is, seeing how you got yourself a really moral stock portfolio investment plan there, Buster. You reckon they got any stock in, say, Massey Energy? That's a good Christian stock to have, because burning coal and mining coal is good for America. Reckon they got any Peabody Energy stock? Reckon they got any Arch Coal stock? Reckon they got any Console? Ah, good moral, Christian, upstanding, God-fearing, America, environment-raping companies. I don't know, man. Don't go to their website. Screw them. But that's the level of hypocrisy we're talking about. And of course, we're talking about the right wing, and we're talking about, well, you know, yeah, hypocrisy. So that's the first 2 hours of the program that have blown by like the wind. Some of you are going to hate me for playing this. But we'll be back. Your phone calls are welcome. 304-658-3333 on your nickel. 877-443-2366. Toll free. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice, and we need all the listener support we can get. You're listening to The Horn, and I'm Bob, and we'll be back.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Bob.
And welcome back, like you went anywhere, or like I did for that matter. 6.5 minutes past the hour. 6.5 minutes past the final hour of tonight's program. A reminder, I'm likely not behind the microphone tomorrow evening, so I can enjoy the time with my bestest sister and her husband. We're having a wonderful time here. Let's see. Let's do go straightway back to the phones, see what's shaking. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello.
Hey there.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, this is Rory.
Yeah, what's going on, Rory?
Not much, Bob. Good to finally talk to you.
It is good. It is good indeed. How you been?
Not bad. I'm ready for a good night's sleep. We've all been kind of...
I think odds are, it looks to me like you've earned it, by golly.
I hope so. We'll find out tomorrow.
You are the, you're the one who's behind all the number crunching and getting the actual facts straight and everything on this Coal River Wind project that Lorella was referring to a few minutes ago. Tell us your take, if you don't mind, on the, just exactly how this all, I mean, how's it all, A, coming together? What are your hopes, your best case scenario, that sort of thing?
Well, I think it's all coming together really well. As far as I've seen, and I've been involved in or learned about a lot of campaigns on a lot of issues, like all over the world for a number of years now. And from what I've seen, I mean, this is probably like the fastest that any campaign has, that I've ever known of has gotten together and gotten to this point. And, the reason it's gotten to this point is because it's such a perfect, I mean, it's such an obvious solution, and it's a solution that I don't think even the coal industry or their political friends could, they don't have anything to say against it. So, I mean, we've had support from people around West Virginia. We've had support from other organizations in the region and across the nation. And they're putting down other things that they're working on to help us succeed right now because they know how important it is. So, 5 months ago when we all started this, I don't think any of us knew we had numbers and we had a study. And I don't think any of us could have even expected that we'd be where we're at right now, only 5 months later. So.
What have you had to do to gather those numbers and get them together and just, were you shocked by anything you saw, Rory?
I wasn't shocked. I mean, I didn't really have anything to compare to. It all started basically with a wind map. And even when, back when I was first trying to put together a model wind farm using GIS software, I didn't know what the heck I was doing. I mean, it's been a learning process since day one, and even after we had a lot of the numbers together, we've all been learning together, and some things that we've learned have been a little disappointing, but other things have been hopeful, and more everybody's getting involved, and it's really. It's really just all the pieces are coming together just at the right time, and it's gone beyond just the numbers, and it's a real kind of coordinated effort.
How did you? Let's just go back and first things first. How did you come to be involved?
I was working. I got an internship with Appalachian Voices. I was in grad school back in the fall of 2006, and some friends of mine. I was studying Latin American environmental degradation and poverty issues, the connection between oil drilling and exploitation of indigenous tribes down in Ecuador and what it was doing to groups down there. And some friends of mine met some Mountain Justice boys at a sit-in at University of Virginia for a living wage action sit-in. And they met the guys playing the banjo, and I was just learning the banjo, so they came back to D.C. and they said, hey, you got to check these guys out. And I looked on their website, on the Mountain Justice website, and I mean, this was 2006, and mountaintop removal had been going on for almost two decades by that point. I'd never heard of it, and I was so blown away and just kind of like appalled that there was nothing I could do other than to sort of switch gears and learn as much as I could. And eventually I got an internship with Appalachian Voices for my grad program, and then one day Matt Watson dropped a wind map on my lap and said, "Go to town." So then we started realizing how viable of an option wind power really was here.
Well, it's become a stunning idea, and the force of the force of the labor and the skull sweat and the day in and the day out. You said, you know, you're about ready for a nap. The effort and the energy that have been put into this are simply, well, they're beyond amazing. They're inspiring, Rory.
It really is.
Because this is the final, and Lorella alluded to this, this is the final piece in the puzzle for this fight, dare I say, for us. Because this is the shattering of the last myth. Because the one thing that the people who want to keep blowing up mountains have been saying is, well, you always just complain. Why don't you give us some alternatives?
Exactly.
Well, here's your alternative, Buster. And it'll pay you better than mountaintop removal does. And you're going to have, you might even have a real pension, a real possibility at a dignified retirement, real health care instead of, you know, having to go to the company doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Here's your alternative. What do you think?
I think that's it. I mean, somehow they still hang on to the jobs argument, even though everybody knows that jobs aren't really the issue anymore. And but even in the jobs argument, we win because, you know, this strip mining is only going to last 14 years. And after that, with wind power, you could have jobs forever. I mean, people can get trained, they can move up in the, you know, within the wind developing organization. Those jobs don't go away. They don't rely on boom and bust cycles. And they are good paying, safe, healthy jobs that don't destroy communities. They don't destroy the water. They provide a sustained tax income for the county, whereas, you know, one day coal's going to run out. And you're right. This is the alternative. And this is why so many groups are rallying around it.
Yeah. Let's get started now, because it's going to take a while to get this up and running. A couple of years to build.
Yeah.
But beyond that, it's going to take a while, to build, to let the communities literally come back from the dead.
Yeah.
So, you know, the sooner started, the better off we are. This project is with regard to Coal River Mountain. Are there other sites that because based on the research you've done, and I don't want you to give away any future plans or anything, Rory, but have you identified other similarly acceptable sites for this kind of thing? I mean, is this something that can bust out of maybe the Coal River Valley and get all over southern West Virginia, northern West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, you know, Virginia?
Well, it all depends. Now, Coal River Mountain was found, basically they identified a site. State level wind maps don't show much wind potential at all. They show like a lot of green where it's class 3 and class 2, which aren't, you need class 4 to have, you know, big wind turbines put on them at least. And so on the state level wind map, you see these tiny little purple dots, and that's what they started focusing in on, and did a micro scale like close up study, and they found that Coal Mountain actually did have really good wind potential, and unfortunately, Cafford Mountain had even more wind potential than Coal Mountain. Cafford Mountain had about 50% more wind potential than Coal Mountain did, and we all know what happened to that. And same with Cherry Pond, just to the west of Coal Mountain. It had almost as much wind potential as Coal River Mountain did, and that's being mined. So, unfortunately, in southern West Virginia, for utility scale wind development, there aren't many other sites. There's one other mountain nearby, and as far as I know, the minerals have already been leased for strip mining, unfortunately. And there hasn't been a model wind map done on that. All the resources have gone into Coal River Mountain so far, but you know, the real thing is that there's deeper issues. Appalachians, especially people in southern West Virginia, any coal producing area, or even timber producing area, it's not just the coal mining. From what everybody responds, you know, people who've lived here, they like the idea of a wind farm, but they also are suspicious because it's just another huge energy coming in and using their mountains and not really leaving any benefit. Now, the Coal River Mountain wind farm would provide benefit.
Built into the model, as I understand it.
It is, and it's built into our own like basic principles of making sure that they're union jobs and making sure that they're locally trained and hired and all that. So, but still, people are wary. And the real solution, for people not just in Appalachia, but all across the United States, is to get small power developed on their houses and in their communities, and have a community or residential owned small solar, a small wind. You know, the only way to really break this cycle of exploitation and sort of like the control over energy provision is to produce your own power and to decentralize the energy production system.
And there's a sustainable energy future out there that I'm sure you've thought about, and I know I've talked with others about. And massive wind farms begin that part of the discussion. But there's a good job future, unless I'm totally mistaken. You can tell me, Rory. There's an energy future in people who know how to maintain, for instance, off the grid solar systems. And those would be pretty much highfalutin, high-paying electrician jobs, wouldn't they?
Oh yeah, totally.
And
exactly.
or maintenance of small wind turbines that could power, a home or two, co-op. And this is all outside the box stuff, isn't it?
Well, it is, but it shouldn't be. I mean, it's outside the box because, apparently, like to be able to buy a wind turbine or to buy a solar panel is cost prohibitive, especially for people who live in less advantaged areas and more impoverished areas. And there's different systems that could be put in place, microloan systems, like they're using the, the Grameen Bank.
Grameen Bank, right.
Grameen Bank, right. I mean, microloan systems for residential and community-owned wind, that would be a beautiful thing to happen, and it would be affordable for people. And the Grameen Bank has been shown that people who get those loans have a 90% payback rate. So it's something that could be implemented here if the initiative was there. And
yeah, what do they call that? Microfinance.
Microfinance, yeah.
Yeah.
Microfinance.
Because I do a lot of surfing, and I would love to get us off the industrial power grid, especially not just my home, not just my family, but particularly the Horn itself. To be able to say that, this operation is entirely solar power, solar and wind, that kind of thing.
That'd be awesome.
And I go and there are websites, that deal in solar supplies and things like that. And I was amazed to find that you can do an off-the-grid system for a complete off-the-grid, totally solar system for, what, $10,000?
Yep.
And that, you couple that with some meaningful tax credits, that kind of thing, and it becomes approachable. And there was a time in this country, Rory, when we had it. That stuff was all rolled back by Ronald Reagan. It was a very, very very symbolic act when the day that he was inaugurated and entered office, the solar panels were pulled down off the White House.
Yep.
And that wasn't because they don't work, or it wasn't because we've just got too much electricity flowing into the White House. It was an entirely symbolic act to show that the hydrocarbon boys were back in the saddle.
Yeah, a lot of good progressive things that Carter did were rolled back on that day, unfortunately.
So I think it is approachable, it is doable. Have you been up to the big gorgeous Irma Bird Center, the higher education complex there outside of Beckley?
No, I've only passed by it. I've seen the wind turbine.
You've seen okay.
Yeah.
Do you know about the wind turbine, Rory?
No, I don't know how much power it produces.
It doesn't.
It doesn't, really?
Yeah.
It's symbolic?
It does not generate so much as a watt.
Yeah, somebody was telling me that they've never seen it spinning.
No, I saw it spinning the day I was there, and it can rotate 360 degrees on its axis basis based upon, whichever way the wind's blowing. There was a storm going through, and it was going like an airplane prop. But
in it.
But it's only gathering data.
Oh, so it's like a mock meteorological tower turbine.
Yeah, and the same thing with the solar panels. It's only gathering data. It's there. Appalachian Power put it in with the construction of the facility, but it does not send so much as a milliampere or volt or watt, or I'm no electrician.
That's
nothing.
You could gather data and produce energy at the same time?
I think that's the electrical equivalent of chewing gum and walking at the same time. Yeah. But it, in fact, I was talking with somebody there at the center, and they, I said, you know, because when I pulled up, I got all excited. Dang, you know, this is a forward-looking, forward-thinking center. It's, it's aimed at the future. Look, they got them a wind turbine. Look, they got them solar panels. And I said, that's cool. You know, how much of that is powering the building? Bob, it's not powering the building. It's just gathering data. It just sits there and looks really cool.
What is that? Why would they do that?
It seems like it's
sort of a symbol of a lot of things in West Virginia.
I suspect it's deliberately self-defeating.
Yeah.
Because the purpose is for Appalachian Power to say, well, say it doesn't work. It doesn't generate enough electricity. Then let's burn more coal.
Have they tried to say that?
No, but I expect that eventually they will. There's a difference between running a race with your foot in the bucket, because that's how it is, and putting your foot in the bucket to run the race in the first place.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. Maybe at some point it'll become viable, but for now it's just gathering data.
Well, I hope it starts actually producing power the day that Governor Manchin decides to support our wind farm proposal.
That would be a beautiful thing, and I hope you guys can get him to do that. Lorella was telling me about what she had, the fun she had talking with the Republican gubernatorial nominee today,
yeah.
And that had to be every bit as much fun as a trip to the dentist. Not because you know, not
no, no, Lorella takes those meetings very well.
She takes them.
Dealt with some really, really just off the wall, like completely heartless things being said during the meetings that we go to, and she holds her composure. So I can't imagine where she.
She's probably much better at that than I would be.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it. She's a lot better at it than I am. I'll tell you that much.
Well, Lorella was telling us that with the kickoff tomorrow, the information and the campaign's going to be reaching about a million people.
Yeah, just about.
Are there any overt partnerships, or is there anybody saying, you know, we're going to be part of this with you, we're standing right there with you? Any groups, any organizations that it's okay to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, well, there was, unfortunately, we still haven't heard from the groups that gave us that go-ahead, that gave us that verbal support. We haven't heard any official support, such as the Four County Economic Development Authority. Judy Radford said to us that she was all for the project. It still had to go through the board. She was really positive. She was really open to everything that we had to say that day. She went up to Kafer with us. So I'm hoping that we still have their support. Most of the support really comes from groups that are also working for positive change. You know, legislators, obviously, in a coal state. I don't know how to read it really, but they're wary of coming out publicly in support of the project because it's an election year. And I'm not speaking to anybody specifically.
No. But election years make a political lion a timid kitten.
Exactly. And what I was going to say was that's where the real test of courage is whether you're willing to stand up against popular opinion or against the status quo. And that's really where strong politicians come from. And, I'm hoping that one stands up and does that, because we really need at least one. You know, one from the county that says this is the best option for this area. You know, this is a viable, real option. And it really is. I mean, we would not have the interest of two of the top renewable energy operators in the world if this was not a real option for West Virginia.
Right. Absolutely. So, you know, just cross your fingers and, you know, well, what did Edison say? I'm a firm believer in luck. I find the harder I work, the more I have of it.
That's a good one.
And if that's the case, you guys ought to be absolutely up to your earlobes in good luck. Because I know the hard work has gone into it.
Yep, you bet.
Well, Rory, please keep us apprised of this as it happens. And if there's something that we need to let the Horn family know, where to go, what to see, breaking news. Let us be the first people you let know, because this is a marvelously, inspiringly activist-oriented audience, and I don't think there's a greater concentration of friends of what Coal River Mountain Watch and the Coal River Wind Project are doing than this group.
I gotta say, Bob, they love you, and I really respect your support and your outreach and your just constant getting behind this organization, because they're one of the greatest group people I've ever known.
I can say, Rory, with no equivocation and no qualification whatsoever, that people like Vernon and Judy and my fellow board member Nanette, and I don't want to miss out on any names, Patty and Janice, and they changed my life. I'm not kidding. They changed my life. They redirected the focus of my existence. They taught me by their own courage, their own heroism, their own dedication, what it means to really pour your being into something that can have long-term ramifications and good impacts and good good. I don't want to say vibes, because that sounds just a little too groovy.
I was about to say vibrations, though.
Yeah, but genuine efforts toward real goodness for people that you may not ever have even dreamt of, and that's something that you don't run across every day, Rory. And I count myself blessed to call them my friends.
And you know what? One day the people who speak out against them and oppose them and harass them. One day they're gonna be coming up to the door of Coal River Mountain Watch asking for help, and eventually everybody's gonna realize what real work, real good, heartful work that they do around here. So.
It just astonishes me. Well, Rory, stay in touch, please, and like I said, let us know as things develop, and we'll be there.
You bet.
All
right, Bob.
Take care, Rory.
You take care.
Bye now. Rory McElmoyle. Rory is another individual intensely and intimately behind and related to this Coal River Wind Project. And I'm not kidding. I am honest to God not kidding. I can't. There's not a lot that makes me speechless. But how the focus of my life has changed, and the meaning of my life has changed by virtue of witnessing the heroism of all of these folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, every last one of them. You can't put a number to it, and you can't put a value to it except to say that it is a value higher than anything that can be reasonably calculated. And that's the best way that I have of describing it. So we've got about call it 20, 25 minutes of conversation left in the program. What do you think? You may not live anywhere near these hills, but can you help? Can you tell your friends and neighbors to go and sign the Coal River Wind petition? Can you help us get names on there in the thousands, the tens of thousands, yea, verily, the hundreds of thousands, perhaps the millions? Can you do that? Can you be the first few flakes in an avalanche that begins to change the future, not just of this region? And I've got to make, I can never make that clear enough, not just this region, but this entire nation. Because if the people of Appalachia, who are treated as if they are barely citizens at all, if the people of Appalachia can put their all into saving this region and this nation, I should certainly hope that it is worth the effort you might make to send out a few emails to sign an electronic petition, to tell your elected representatives in far-flung places far away from these hills and hollers that they are the ones who can step up to the plate and begin to make a difference in the lives of people who are under under attack. Because this has everything in the world to do with the definition of what it means to be an American. If we go back to some of our history, I think it was Shelby Foote, the great Civil War historian, who said that prior to the Civil War, the language convention was to say the United States are, and that after the Civil War, the language convention became to say the United States is. That there was indeed a unity that came about as a result of it. And with that in mind, it is worth considering what, and I'm not directing this directly at you because I know that by virtue of the fact that you listen to these programs, you know how intensely I feel about my Appalachian heritage and the Appalachian heritage of those around me and what it means to be an Appalachian American. But can we begin to redefine what it means to have a relationship, even though it be a relationship in which we may never meet? What it means to have a relationship within this country with your fellow countrymen? Can we have that conversation? There are 937 signatures on the Coal River Wind petition. Can you find, just by virtue of the power of the horn, the power of the horn that you create, can you find 63 people via your emails, your email lists? Can you find 63 people to push that to 1,000 signatures, four digits? You never know what will happen with those 63 signatures. You never know which one of them is going to be the one that begins the avalanche coming down the mountainside that changes Appalachia forever. You see, my region of the country has bled and died. We have been plagued with sickness. Black lung has made widows out of young women. Coal mine disasters have made widows out of newlyweds. Appalachia has done its part to make this country as great as it has been. When you're on an interstate and you approach a gleaming American city in the night, when you're driving I-20 eastbound toward Atlanta, and you see those glistening glass towers rising up out of the trees like something positive, like something out of a fantasy. All that light happens, for the most part, because in Appalachia, children walk around with asthma rescue inhalers in their pockets. The gleaming cities that you see in satellite photography and satellite imagery that look so stunning at first glance, those little sparkling diamond points of light taken from distant space, those happen, you see, because Appalachian children go to bed with their clothes on when it rains, because they never know when the sludge dam will break and they don't want to be found naked when it does. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Whether it's New York or Boston or Chicago, whether it's Nashville or Charlotte or Memphis or Birmingham or New Orleans, what's left of it, in large part, the electricity they have because of the manifest suffering of a region of this country they barely even consider exists. The Gateway Arch sits in St. Louis on the west bank of the Mississippi River. It should probably sit on top of a mountain somewhere in southern West Virginia. Because indeed, this Appalachia is the gateway to everything that was made possible in virtually the rest of the country. And I think about that stuff. I do. That is the transformative change that my association with these people that I love so dearly at Coal River Mountain Watch have made in me. And that is why I come unstuck and want to lose everything that relates to any degree of self-control when I see someone like Illinois Republican Representative, Member of Congress, John Shimkus. Schmuckus. Shimkus. Yeah, okay, Shimkus. You see, the right wing in this country does one word does not exist in the right wing's vocabulary in this country. You will never hear a right winger. You will never hear a Focker, a friend of Coal, a fiend of Coal. You will never hear Don Blankenship or the CEO of Peabody or the CEO of Arch or all the CEO of ExxonMobil, all these hydrocarbon kings. You will never hear any of them utter the word enough. And their little minions in the Congress and in the halls of our government generally, be it the White House, the Congress, or the courts, are as likely to use the word enough as they are to come out and admit their own hypocrisy. In other words, entirely unlikely. So when I think of the children in Appalachia, when I think of the widows made early, when I think of the strong men made old before their day, when I think of all of those things, like I said, I come damn close to losing all of my ability to keep my composure when I hear somebody like Representative John Shimkus, who doesn't know the meaning of the word enough, moving from the inexorable drive to drill on anything that doesn't have a derrick on it already to phase two. You want to hear phase two? Here, by God, is phase two.
I'm John Shimkus, represent the 19th District of Southern Illinois. You know, if drilling is good, drilling and mining is better. If you hear the Democrats say it's drill, drill, drill. Well, I've been here, as you know, for a long time. It's drilling and mining and using great resources like Illinois Coal. You all follow the congressional baseball game. I wore this uniform. Proudly, it says the miners, the mining industry. And coal is part of the solution. If the speaker...
You carry that coal in your pocket, Congressman Shimkus. Take a big old damn bite of it. Eat it. See if it's good. Grind it into powder and sprinkle it over the nostrils of your sleeping children, you sorry rat bastard son of a bitch, you. Grind it into a powder and pour it in a glass of cold water and guzzle it down, you merciless monster. Do it! Because, by God, from southern Illinois to the hills of West Virginia, western Virginia, eastern Kentucky, and eastern Tennessee, our children do it. You do it. You do it. It's not just drill, drill, drill. It's drill and mine. You do it. You do it. This is from when the Repiglicans were having their little protest on energy regulation. You remember the one that John Boehner, the House Minority Leader, wanted? Now is the time for all good Republicans to come to the aid of their country. Except me. I'm on the golf course. Catch me at the 19th hole. I'll be the guy with the gin and tonic. Yeah. Listen again. Listen again. If this doesn't make your blood boil... what? What, Bob? If it doesn't make my blood boil, what? You know.
I'm John Shemkus, represent the 19th District of Southern Illinois. You know, if drilling is good, drilling and mining is better. If you hear the Democrats say it's drill, drill, drill. Well, I've been here, as you know, for a long time. It's drilling and mining. And using great resources like Illinois coal. You all follow?
You bastard. Tell that to the widows of Sago. Tell them how good mining is, the widows of Aracoma. Tell the widows of Crandall Canyon, Congressman Shimkus, who were sentenced to death by Bob Murray. Tell them how good coal is. Tell them that coal is so good that their loved ones' lives aren't worth as much as that precious, poisonous rock you carry in your pocket. Tell them! Look them in the eye, Shimkus. Look them in the eye. Man up, Shimkus! Talk to the widows, Shimkus. Talk to the men with the portable oxygen containers hooked to their noses, who have to wear it to go across a room, Shimkus. Tell them! You stand there in your stupid little business suit and talk about how good mining is. You demon!
Oh, the congressional baseball game, I wore this uniform. Proudly it says, the miners. The mining industry and coal is part of the solution. You have to speak.
If coal is part of the solution in the sweet name of all that is holy, what is the problem? I'm sorry, but... Oh, well, you know, Bob, you tree hugger. The problem is America's dependence on foreign oil. The problem is the American energy crisis. No, the problem is the bottom line of your stinking stock portfolio, you bought-off, bribe-taken freak. How much did they give your pack in order to have you carry the little lump of coal up there like it was your dearest, dearest talisman, Congressman Shimkus? How much did the coal industry pay you?
Her brings her bill, and it doesn't come through regular order, is part of the solution. If the Speaker brings her bill and it doesn't come through regular order, which she promised when she first came in, right? Regular order through the committee process. If it comes through the committee process, we will have increased use of coal. If she brings her bill to the floor without regular order, you're not going to have one smidgen of new supply of coal in the bill. It's not going to be...
What? I think he did eat some of it. And I think there was a little bit of LSD on it. There's not going to be a new supply of coal. Hey, dumbass, there's no new supply of coal. They quit making it.
It's a finite resource, you doofus, and it's on the way out. Not that I'd expect you to comprehend something all complicated like that. Finite, has an end, not going to be here forever, not much of it left. But you know what? If John Shimkus was asked by the coal companies to rip the beating heart out of an Appalachian child and eat it on camera, he would! They're not members of Congress. They're bought and paid for little lickspittles. Little toadies. Little creatures. Little things. And they have about as much free will as the polio virus. These creatures of coal. These fuckers. Lord God. Now you see, I carry this rock in my pocket. It makes me feel good about myself. If drilling is good, drilling and mining is better. Well, if drilling is good, and drilling and mining is better, then drilling and mining and eating children is best. Drilling and mining and just blowing up the damn planet is the ultimate good. What are you, some sort of fundy? Now the Lord said, I'll give you dominion over all the earth. See, that's where so much of this stuff comes from. Good Lord. Matthew Iglesias says, and this is from Think Progress. You can go hear this over at Think Progress, thinkprogress.org. Matthew Iglesias says, it's true that if we think we should give zero consequences to the environmental, economic, and public health harms caused by the resource extraction activities of the fossil fuel industry, then we really should go beyond mining in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge and all along America's coastline. Why not tear up as much of the country as possible looking for coal? No. No, sorry, Matt. It's NIMBY. You'll look for it in the Powder River Basin. Out west, you'll look for it in southern Illinois. You'll look for it in Appalachia. Places where the people who live there aren't considered to be quite American enough or quite human enough to merit your concerns. If drilling is good, drilling and mining is better. And there won't be any new supplies of coal if Nancy Pelosi has any. Oh, Nancy Pelosi, there won't be new supplies of coal. What a fool. It's all old supplies of coal. Well, you know, but then again, these people are probably young earthers, and they think that there's just a little coal factory under the ground. It's like licorice. That's what it is. It just pops up out of the ground like mushrooms after a rain. Oh, look, there's some more coal. God, I get so tired of this. Because I live here. I do know what it does. I do know what it is doing to these communities. Coal keeps the lights on. Coal, your carbon neutral coal. Carbon neutral carbon. That's coal. Carbon neutral carbon. And I wish, I don't know, maybe I should take some time sometime and just go and take a, shoot a bunch of video and take a bunch of photographs. You need to see, the county seat of Mingo County. You need to see what Williamson looks like. You need to see Welch in McDowell County. You need to see what Logan looks like.
now. Oh, yes, you do. You need to see Madison. You need to see Hamlin. These dead places where there's nothing for the young people and no hope, no hope, no hope for any of them except for a prayer that they get out. There's no economy here. There's no growth. What? My wife and I are raising three kids, helping to raise a couple of grandbabies. And I'm supposed to sit here and get all worked up and excited because maybe my son can quit high school at 16 and go to work learning to run a D9 Caterpillar and destroying his own progeny's future and making an old man of himself. I'm supposed to feel good about that because if drilling is good, drilling and mining is better. I'd feel a lot better if the young people of these communities had a job that they could look forward to that would give them a future and a pension. I know. There aren't just a hell of a lot of 12-year-olds worrying about their pension. But their daddies do. And their mamas. And their grandmas. And their grandpas. Because that's our job. But this miracle coal economy doesn't present anything for the youth of this state, the children. That's the future that my daughters have to look forward to? Marrying up maybe with a high school dropout who's operating heavy machinery and blowing up mountains? So that they can then procreate and have children with IQ deficits or maybe autism or God only knows what from the poisons and toxins that daddy brings home from the mountaintop removal site? That's the hope of the future? Kiss my ass. Not y'all, the coal industry. Heard the audio earlier today. And honest to God, I got up out of my chair here in the studio and just had to walk outside because I could not believe that there were that big a bunch of horses' rear ends. Yeah, of course I could believe it. But when you are confronted with it, right there, right through your own little eyeballs, in through your ears, and you see this freak hold up this little black rock as if it was something innocuous, knowing that it contains radiation, knowing that it contains radioactive materials, knowing that it contains virtually every toxin known to humanity, and stands up there like he's holding up a diamond, like he's holding up the Hope Diamond. Too much to ask one human being to tolerate, really, if you get right down to it. So that's why I had to, that's why I had to walk out of it. Carbon neutral coal. And the billboards are all over West Virginia, like, yeah, there it is in the chat room. Clean carbon neutral coal. Yes, coal! Golly Moses. So that's how the show ends this evening. I'm not entirely certain if I will be behind the microphone tomorrow night. Odds are not. Because opportunities like this to be with those that Van Morrison calls one's own ones don't come along too terribly often. But if I'm not here Tuesday, I'll be back Wednesday. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing your time with us, as always. That is the most profound thing you can do, is share your time, because it is finite. Thank you from the bottom of my heart to the hardest working, bravest people I know, my friends, my brothers and sisters at Coal River Mountain Watch. CoalRiverWind.org is where the petition is. Go there. Do the right thing. Don't forget September the 16th, an opportunity to stand shoulder to shoulder with these people, my friends, my brothers, my sisters. If you can be in Charleston, it's a beautiful time of year to be here. Thanks to John Fox and Peter Godbold, our chief engineer and IT professional, respectively. At a considerable distance, they make sure that everything in this studio does what it's supposed to, and they do it selflessly. Thank you to Ben Birch, the hardest working man in liberal talk, who almost single-handedly saved liberal talk on the Internet starting about 2002. WhiteRoseSociety.org. If you value what happens on the horn, you value WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you to all of you who contribute to keep the horn going. It is your efforts that keep independent conversation happening. And I am, and we all are, humbled by your efforts. Thanks to the moderators in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, our bloggers. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.
Listening to the Head On Radio Network. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Get on the get on the get on the get on the get on.
Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of West By God, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid!
Well, howdy! All right, we're all set. Usually I banter a little bit before getting into the full swing of the show, you know that. But tonight we're going to go straight to the meat of the program. Even the music's been inspected. John Fox crafted that intro in an attempt to make sure that not one single note had ever been played by either Billy Joel or the Grateful Dead, and they haven't. We're serious about this. This is a professional operation. I first became aware of Anthony Bourdain a long, long time ago on a cable network, probably not far enough away from Mr. Bourdain's liking. From the first episode, well, I was hooked. You know me well enough to know that No Reservations is literally the only TV show I make the conscious effort to watch. Hell, back when we were doing the horn section, I had my contract stipulate that I got Monday nights off. I actually know when No Reservations airs, and I've been known to stay up late to catch the rerun. I even sat down to an episode of Yo Gabba Gabba with my granddaughter when Tony was on. Yeah, I'm a fan. Why? Well, because in an entertainment industrial complex world awash in reality shows that are anything but, Anthony Bourdain is as much as television can be, real. So's his writing. From Kitchen Confidential through A Cook's Tour and The Nasty Bits, I've enjoyed every printed word. Even more than the television, it's proven thought-provoking. In an era when even the news, the staple of my existence, is as often vapid as it is substantive. So we come tonight to Mr. Bourdain's new book, Medium Raw, A Bloody Valentine to the World of Food and the People Who Cook, out this summer from Echo Press, a HarperCollins imprint. This is much more than a food book. And Anthony Bourdain is much more than a guy who writes about food. Anthony Bourdain, welcome to the horn.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. I'm just tickled pink. Let me ask, just to get things going. Medium Raw is full of observations that let readers know that you sort of suspect that what you're doing is a kind of a fleeting transient. bigger stuff out there. You've just gotten back, as I understand from your publicist, from what I hope was a relaxing and pleasant vacation. And you come back to see your beloved New York City and the rest of the country embroiled over a tempest in a teapot over the Muslim equivalent of a YMCA with lots of folks who know less than, you know, about New York than a hillbilly like me. Do you just want to run screaming back to JFK and get on the plane?
Yeah, man. I don't know. I mean, intolerance, being a territorial, intolerant, jingoistic, xenophobic, tribalism. I mean, that's something I see a lot of around the world. But it's unlovely to see, in my hometown. I mean, to his credit, our mayor has been very cool about it, to come down on the right side of the issue. Yes, of course, it's enraging him, but yes, I want to run right back to where I was. I want to go right back to Italy.
Well, it just occurred to me because there was a strange irony in the fact that the last new episode of No Reservations that aired before this conversation, last week's episode, was Dubai.
Yeah.
And it has to, of course, you know, that's long ago old history in your book, but there has to be something odd insofar as you meet people who are really decent human beings all around the globe, and it comes out in your work. And to see this kind of thing going on in this country has got to be a little bit unsettling.
Well, like I like to say a lot, I mean, I don't have to agree with you to like you or respect you. In fact, I could disagree violently with what you have to say, and I feel I could still sit down, have a decent meal, we could get along and hopefully respect each other. I think that's the same thing in my heart that allows me to sit down in Saudi Arabia and have dinner with people and at least try to see their point of view to whatever extent I can, you know, allows me to be friends with Ted Nugent, frankly. I don't see any difference between the two. People go berserk and get a lot of angry mail when we shoot a very sympathetic program in Laos, talking about what happened there during the Vietnam War and the effect it's had on people since. I get a lot of howls from the couch Rambos. But I have to say that the wails and screams of horror and outrage whenever we have Ted Nugent on the show are at least as loud and at least as crazed. So, you know, it just seems like the level of discourse in the country as a whole has gotten so cartoonish as to avoid, you know, a basic, like, civility.
So I take it then from what you just said that I'm not the only one that reads some sort of relevance, and I don't want to sound like some guy who plays records backwards or anything, but that sees some sort of relevance in your work that transcends, if I may, mere issues of food.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't have any political agenda when I go to a country or to do a program at all. But when you sit down, I mean, but by the same token, I'm not going to avoid the elephant in the room. I mean, you learn a lot about a culture by what people are eating, how hospitable they are, literally what's on your plate. It tells you a lot about, you know, what people love, about their culture, where they came from. But it also tells you that if, you know, 80% of their diet is bread, you know, that's... You might want to mention why. If your host is missing, you know, three of his four limbs, it's worth asking the question, you know, gee fella, you know, where'd your limbs go? That alone is a political act. You know, eating is a political act even. So, I guess that's had to kind of leach into the show and then in the course of making the show, I'm just out there looking to, you know, get drunk, have a good time, and eat. You know, I've been in a few uprisings, insurrections, you know, civil problems, and even a war. So those things do kind of get up and in your face.
Well, and both your TV work and your writing, and I hope you will not take this as an insult, has journalistic qualities to it. And I say not take it as an insult, mainly because so much of journalism is insulting these days. That journalistic quality, you come back to America from all these varied and different places, and in Medium Raw, you address issues as varied as the state of the American hamburger. The fact that even so-called foodies, very few of them can actually cook. Whether kids need organic gardens in the back of the elementary school, or whether they need to be able to know that they're not going to get shot going to school that day. All of this started, if I understand your sort of autobiography correctly, with a fairly simple piece for the New Yorker. Was the urge to report always underneath it all, or were you just getting it off your chest?
I think I'm a bit of a provocateur. I think I just kind of can't help that. I think that goes back to it's a childish and childhood impulse. I like to point out the obvious. It seems so many people don't.